on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Starts this morning at 9:30.
On 92 to 95 FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker, this is BBC Radio 4.
It's 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 6th of November. Good morning. This is Today with Emma Barnett in London and Justin Webb in Washington, D.C. The headlines this morning. Donald Trump has made the first breakthroughs in the crucial swing states, which will decide whether he or Kamala Harris will win the U.S. presidential election. He is projected to take both North Carolina and Georgia. In state after state over the course of the night, the picture has been the same. Key groups of voters Kamala Harris needed to be coming out for her did not come out for her in the numbers needed. The most striking of those groups is Latino voters who seem to have voted in record numbers for a Republican presidential candidate. Donald Trump easily won both Florida and Texas with their help. North Carolina and Georgia are the only swing states to have been called, but others may well be called soon. The feeling is growing that this election might be over soon, as his allies have been claiming.
I think at the end of the night, when they tabulate all this, I am very hopeful that we're going to have not only a larger majority in the House, but we retake the Senate and the White House as well. I think that's what's going to happen.
We've also been hearing from friends of Kamala Harris.
We know that sexism and misogyny are very real viruses that have infected this country and so many others. But I'm hopeful.
Anthony Zercher, our Washington correspondent, will be with us throughout the program.
Donald Trump has won two of those seven battleground states, and the blue wall that Kamala Harris was depending on, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, seem to be in danger of falling to the Republicans as well, delivering the White House to Donald Trump.
And we are expecting to hear from Mr. Trump himself within the next hour.
Also, in today's program, good morning, what does the sacking of Israel's defense minister tell us about the direction of Benjamin Netanyahu's war strategy? And coming to UK politics, as Kemi Badenoch prepares for her first Prime Minister's questions, we'll ask two former Conservative cabinet ministers what sort of opposition leader will she be. The BBC News is read by Vigi Alice.
Donald Trump has made the first crucial breakthroughs of the night as votes are counted in the US presidential election. He is projected to win North Carolina and Georgia, two of the seven swing states which he has fought over with Kamala Harris. Our U.S. partner CBS has not yet made a call on the other key states, but the mood at Ms. Harris's campaign headquarters has become anxious. Our North America editor Sarah Smith is there and has just sent this report.
After a long, stressful, tumultuous campaign, Americans are eager for this election to be over. But they're going to have to wait a while yet to find out who will be the next president of the United States. As the earliest results came in, Donald Trump began to build a significant lead over Kamala Harris, but only in the states he had been expected to win, places like Texas and Florida, as she notched up wins in reliably Democrat states like New York and Massachusetts. The anxiety in both camps was building through the night as they watched the results trickle in from the seven key battleground states that were always going to decide the outcome. The first of those to be called was North Carolina, which is projected to be won by Donald Trump, creating rising anxiety in the Kamala Harris campaign.
This is a big one. It's North Carolina, 16 electoral votes go to former President Donald Trump. He has won the state of North Carolina tonight. Let's get right over to...
Ms. Harris does not need North Carolina to win the White House, but at this point in the night, she's also watching Donald Trump's vote count overtake hers in many of the states that she must win to have a chance of victory. Without all the votes counted yet, it's impossible to say who will be the ultimate victor. Either candidate could pull ahead, and it may be several hours at least before we have the final results.
Our correspondent Gary O'Donoghue has spent the night at Donald Trump's headquarters in Florida and sent this report.
The anticipation has grown throughout the night here, the crowd increasingly believing that Donald Trump is on his way to a second term in the White House. Thousands of invited guests watched the big screens as the results poured in, cheering every state called in favour of the former president. But this is by no means over until the votes in those key swing states are finally counted. However, those in the crowd were oozing confidence.
I hope he wins. Let me go to the White House and we save America.
I did not sleep well last night. I don't know if I'm going to make it. through the end of this, but I'm having fun.
While the outcome of this election is not certain, it's undoubtedly the case that Kamala Harris's path to victory has become a narrow one. The Trump campaign is feeling very confident.
Kamala Harris's officials have just announced that she won't be addressing her supporters tonight. Mandela Barnes has helped organize the Harris campaign in the contested state of Wisconsin. He still hopes for victory.
We are pleased with what we have been seeing. And, you know, as far as Milwaukee, counting of the ballots will go late into the night. But our program here on the ground has been unlike anything else. Voters in Milwaukee have been enthusiastic and they have turned out in early voting in record numbers.
The FBI says its name and logo have been used in several false messages about the election. The agency also said hoax bomb threats were directed at polling stations in swing states, including Georgia, Michigan, and Wisconsin. It said the threats appeared to come from Russia. The Russian embassy in Washington called the allegations malicious slander. The Republicans are projected to have gained Senate seats in Ohio and West Virginia, which would give them control of the chamber. In the House of Representatives, where the Republicans are on course to retain their majority, all 435 seats are up for grabs. Our North America correspondent Peter Bowes reports.
The balance of power in Congress can make or break a new president's aspirations to bring about change in America. With votes still being counted, the Republicans are projected to win the Senate after gaining two seats. The Texan Ted Cruz, a close ally of Donald Trump, held his seat after a strong campaign by a Democratic challenger. The Republicans have also picked up a seat in the House, but it's too early to call the final result. In Delaware, voters made history electing Sarah McBride, a Democrat, as the first openly transgender member of Congress. In a notable governor's race, the Democratic candidate in North Carolina defeated a Republican who's been mired in controversy over comments he's alleged to have made on a pornographic website.
In this morning's other news, thousands of Israelis have taken to the streets to protest against the dismissal of the defense minister, Yoav Gallant. Police in Tel Aviv used water cannon and horses to disperse them. Mr. Gallant was sacked by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu last night because of what he called a crisis of trust. Our correspondent Joe Inwood reports from Jerusalem.
Yoav Gallant and Benjamin Netanyahu have long had a difficult relationship. It is now broken. The now former defence minister said his desire to compromise and get a hostage deal, to make ultra-Orthodox Jews serve in the military, and the need for an inquiry into the October the 7th attacks were behind his dismissal. The Prime Minister said trust had cracked between the pair. Water cannon and horses were used to disperse protesters who took to the street overnight. Yoav Gallant will be replaced by Israel Katz, thought to be even more hawkish on the current conflict.
Joe Inwood reporting.
Vijay, thank you for that. Well, moving away from political weather, let's get a bit more of the usual weather from Simon King at the BBC Weather Centre. Good morning.
Morning, Emma. You say the usual weather, and it really is the usual weather at the moment because high pressure is stuck across the UK and it's giving us very, very familiar conditions for many of us this morning. It's a mild start to the day. There are some mist and fog patches and a lot of cloud. Now, there is one exception to that, and that is in the northeast of Scotland where we've got some clear skies and that allowed temperatures to fall close to freezing this morning. But let's start off in southwest, southeast England and eastern England across Wales and the Midlands, where there are some mist and fog patches this morning. The visibilities should improve over the next few hours, but it's going to stay really quite cloudy and overcast all day. There are light winds, so pretty calm, but mild really. Temperatures about 13 to 15 degrees Celsius, but we may also see the odd 16 or 17 degrees just the north of high ground in Devon and across Wales. Now, for northwest and northeast England and Northern Ireland, some mist, some fog, some low cloud. Again, the mist and fog will clear again. There's going to be very little change with the weather outside, really. Lots of cloud. Perhaps some breaks possible in northeastern England. Temperatures 13 to 15 degrees, but locally about 16 or 17 Celsius in Northern Ireland. Across Scotland, as I mentioned, it's a chilly start in the northeast of Scotland. Some clear skies here, and that's where there'll be some sunshine today. Pretty cloudy elsewhere. We have got a little bit of rain in the northwest of Scotland. Otherwise, though, it's going to stay cloudy. Temperatures 13 to 16 degrees. And I have to say, there is very little change in the weather in the coming week, really. Staying largely dry with lots of cloud and temperatures on the relatively mild side.
Simon, thank you. 9 minutes past six here in Washington, D.C. I'm joined by Anthony Zercher, our Washington correspondent, who has been looking at all the results coming in overnight. Just bring us up to date, first of all, Anthony, with what we can say with any certainty about what's going on.
Well, we can say that this election has tilted towards Donald Trump across the board. If you look at all of the counties that have been counted, not just in battleground states, but in all the states, a majority of them, a vast majority of them, Donald Trump is outperforming his 2020 results. So clearly the electoral mood here is one that was against the incumbent party, against the Democrats, and Donald Trump has capitalized on that. And now if you look at the battleground states, the seven that we've been focusing on since the very beginning, Donald Trump has won two of them, North Carolina and Georgia. He leads in the three Great Lakes battleground states of Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. And we're still waiting for results from Arizona and Nevada. But that blue wall that the Democrats were counting on, at least for the time being, it looks like Donald Trump is cutting into them. And he's built up margins that it will be difficult for Kamala Harris to eat into, even when the cities fully report their votes.
Yeah, not impossible for her to do, but it would be quite a turnaround now.
It would be. I think the mood you can sense from the two sides is dramatically different. Republicans are celebrating. Democrats are in shock. This feels much more like 2016 when I was at the Javits Center, when Hillary Clinton lost that election, and the shock and anguish that Democrats were feeling, that is being replicated now among the Kamala Harris faithful.
And we are hearing that Kamala Harris, who was going to be speaking at Howard University, her old university here in Washington, D.C., apparently now not.
Apparently not, which is another big tell. Cedric Richmond, the campaign co-chair, came out and told what was left of the crowd there that there are still votes to be counted, states that have not been called. They're going to keep fighting for these votes, but that there was going to be no speech from their candidate tonight. So yeah. I think this is all the arrows are pointing in one direction at this point. And this was a toss-up election coming into today. But as happens sometimes in close elections, it seems like everything has broken one candidate's way, and that candidate appears to be Donald Trump.
Are we learning from exit polls what it is that has motivated people to vote apparently as they have?
Well, the economy was a big issue, and maybe the biggest issue. In the end, economy trumps everything else, and there was a considerable amount of voter anger, frustration over the state of the economy over the past 4 years, and voters who look back at Donald Trump's presidency, at least pre-COVID Donald Trump's presidency, and sees an economy that they liked. And inflation after 2 years, the first 2 years of the Biden presidency, even though it's gone down now, that was something they didn't like. And so they want to go back to the way it was. And this is a trend that we don't just see here in the United States, but we have seen incumbent parties around the world suffer because of inflation and because of the post-pandemic disruptions that we had seen.
Anthony, thank you. We'll be hearing from you throughout the course of the next few hours. And obviously, we are expecting some pretty big news, including potentially Donald Trump speaking within the next hour, we are told. But let us turn to one of those states you mentioned, Georgia, one of the two swing states that have so far been called for Donald Trump. And John Sudworth, our correspondent, is there. What can you tell us, John?
Yeah, well, it's huge news just to have Georgia called for Donald Trump. This was a state that he lost to Joe Biden back in 2020.
Yeah, look, John, I'm going to have to interrupt you because the line is just not good enough to hear you. We'll try to get back to you, but for the time being, John Sudworth and Anthony Searcher as well. Thanks.
At 13 minutes past six, let's go to Israel, where there have been protests across the country last night in response to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's decision to sack his defence minister, Yoav Gallant, saying there was a crisis of trust between them. Our BBC correspondent in Jerusalem, Joe Inwood. Joe, what can we say about this? How big were the protests? Where were they happening? And what were they in response to specifically?
So there were many thousands of people on the streets here in Jerusalem, where I am, and in Tel Aviv and in other places around the country. People had taken to the streets to protest against the firing of Yoav Gallant. Now, he's been the defence minister since before the start of the war, and there's always been a fractious relationship between him and the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. There have been reports of shouting matches. He was thought of really as one of the few people in the cabinet that really stood up to the Prime Minister. And it seems that relationship has now broken beyond repair. Benjamin Netanyahu said there was a crisis of confidence and that trust had cracked. But what was really interesting is when Yoav Gallant spoke yesterday, he was much more explicit about what those differences were. He said there were three key points of disagreement between the two men. One of them was the need to get a hostage deal done. And he said that difficult compromises need to be made, but those are compromises this country could take. The second point, it was about the recruitment or the conscription of ultra-Orthodox Jews in this country. Now, all Israelis have to serve in the military, but there are exemptions for large parts of the population. And that's something that many people, Mr. Gallant included, wanted to see changed or brought to an end. And then finally, the final point was the need for an inquiry into the events around October the 7th to work out what happened, what lessons could be learned, and where blame could be apportioned. And for Mr. Gallant, those were the key issues that led to his dismissal.
We'll come back to this story a bit later in the programme. Joe Inwood, thank you.
6:15, back to the United States into the election here, into the state of Georgia, where John Sudworth was trying to talk to us, but we couldn't hear him properly, and he's back on the line. John, what were you saying?
So, yeah, obviously huge news to have Georgia call for Donald Trump. He lost this state to Joe Biden back in 2020 by just something like 11,000 votes. He has taken it back by 150,000 or so. It's clearly a significant milestone on his planned route to the White House. We've been watching the results unfold here at a Republican watch party in Atlanta. You might be able to hear the crashes and bangs as people clear up behind me. People have left now, but they have left feeling very, very buoyant indeed. They feel that victory is within their grasp. And there's some pretty positive news in the detail of this result as well, Justin. You know, if you look, drill down into the counties, it shows Donald Trump has built on his support in rural parts of this state where he was already very strong. But he's also picked up some votes in some of the urban counties as well, counties around Atlanta. I think Republican analysts will feel that that is very positive news as they look ahead to the next target states.
Right. John Sudworth in Georgia. Thank you.
Well, while America waits for official results, investors around the world are making decisions on what they've seen overnight and what they can deduce. Sean Farrington is here. What's been happening, I suppose you could say, at the moment on the world's stock markets and currencies, Sean?
Yes. Well, in Japan, which we often look at this time of the morning, the leading stocks and shares index there, the Nikkei 225, is up more than 2.5% overnight. The dollar's got stronger on the whole against other currencies. Bitcoin jumped at one point, reaching a record high of over $75,000. I'm joined by Ronald Temple, Chief Market Strategist at the Global Financial Advisory and Asset Management firm Lazard. Ronald, good morning to you.
Good morning.
What's the thinking behind these moves when you see what investors, your colleagues, will be doing?
Well, I think some of the moves are as you would expect, given the policy proposals presented by Donald Trump. Well, we've seen he's been very much in favor of crypto, so not a surprise that Bitcoin is at a new all-time high. We're seeing the U.S. 10-year Treasury yield up materially this morning. At one point, it was up almost 20 basis points.
On that one, Ronald, sorry to interrupt you. So this is the effective cost of borrowing for the U.S. government. Yeah. Why would that be rising?
There's an expectation that Donald Trump is more likely to increase the size of the U.S. budget deficit. So U.S. 10-year yield now up 15 basis points. I mean, he has campaigned on a promise of making personal tax cuts permanent, further reducing corporate tax rates, and an array of other tax reductions, all of which would pretend for lower government revenue with no offsetting decreases in spending. So effectively, you look for higher deficits, so a higher cost of servicing the government debt, which should translate through to higher cost for credit for consumers and corporates. The other thing we're seeing, by the way, in the market is that small cap stocks, so smaller company stocks, the Russell 2000 futures up 2.6%, the S&P 500 futures up 1.1%. So S&P obviously being large cap, Russell 2000 being small cap. So seeing a benefit there from a perceived positive influence from protectionist policies that might help more domestically oriented companies in the U.S. So unsurprising results so far in terms of the early market moves.
Would you be expecting a big gear change then from those huge wave of subsidies and incentives for green investments that we've seen under Joe Biden?
You know, what's interesting on that is one of the most common questions I've gotten in the last few months is, would Trump repeal the Inflation Reduction Act? My thought is no, and that's the view of our geopolitical advisory team. And the reason is the bulk of the spending from the Inflation Reduction Act is actually in states controlled by Republicans. Perhaps this is, you know, a brilliant stroke in terms of the energy transition business. But a lot of the spending has been in Georgia and Texas and other states that are predominantly Republican, which means you're less likely to see a repeal. What we would expect to see, though, is potentially a decrease in subsidies for electric vehicles. Although, you know, given Elon Musk's prominent role in the campaign, perhaps that could even change.
Yeah, of course, boss of Tesla. Ronald, we don't yet know the official result as much as investors are acting the way they are. I just wonder what you are taking from how the votes have been cast, the ones that we know, the areas, the demographics that have backed each candidate. And are there specific issues about the economy that have maybe come to the fore more than some thought?
You know, I think voters have expressed concern and anger over inflation, which, you know, I think it's interesting in the U.S. It tends to be a relatively insular approach to thinking about economic issues. Clearly, the U.K. had an even worse inflation problem than the U.S. Continental Europe had higher inflation. So it's been a global phenomenon across developed markets. But I do think inflation and immigration played a pretty important role. Those were always topics where the Republicans led in the polls, as opposed to women's health and reproductive rights, where the Democrats led. But I think what was expected was, if the polls were wrong, that there would be a consistent break on one side or the other, meaning either the polls would underrepresent Trump supporters for the third time in a row, or they would underrepresent the views of women voters and other people on the Harris camp. It does seem so far that if you look at Georgia and North Carolina, both having been called in favor of Trump, and if I look at the other five key swing states, Trump in the lead in all five, it does seem that the polls undercounted or underrepresented the Trump support systematically.
Just finally, Ronald, what now for global trade? I mentioned stock markets in Japan up, but those in China and Hong Kong particularly, stock markets are down there. Are investors getting ready for a change in the dynamics of global trade?
Well, that's the part that's a bit surprising, is I would think that non-U.S. markets should be trading lower, if not materially lower, because Trump has campaigned on a platform of imposing a 10% tariff on all imports into the U.S. and a 60% tariff on imports from China. And so I would think, you know, the idea that the Nikkei is up 2.5%, the Hang Seng down 2%, well, maybe the Hang Seng makes sense. But I do believe what you should expect to see is, as investors have time to assess these results, expect a stronger dollar and expect a negative relative performance of non-U.S. markets relative to the U.S. market, because Trump's policies are indeed negative for non-U.S. economies.
Ronald, thank you so much for joining us. Ronald Temple, Chief Market Strategist at that big investment firm, Lazard. I'm joined as well by an investor here in the UK, Gervase Williams, Head of Equities at Premier Miton. Morning, Gervase.
Good morning, Sean.
You invest in businesses right around the UK. How, when you hear what Ronald is saying about US strategies and global trade impact, what will businesses, how should businesses be thinking any differently, given what investors are thinking right now?
Well, I think it does mark quite a decisive shift away from globalization towards more protectionism. And I think that's going to be the overwhelming feature. What we've seen is that actually equity markets perhaps are peaking already. Their valuations have already moved up very substantially in the US. And we're now going to move back to small companies. We're seeing small companies beginning to revive in the US. And I think that's going to be a wider feature across the European market as well.
Okay, so what would you expect to happen in London at 8 o'clock this morning?
Well, the interesting thing about the London market is we're actually much more defensive. A lot of our companies generate surplus cash. They're capital intensive. They tend to generate yield. If we are going to a more unsettled economic environment, then actually this is going to be very favourable for the UK. My own view is the UK market, irrespective of the UK economy or indeed anything on the government side, is going to be the top performer probably for the next 10 or 20 years.
Meanwhile, something we've been talking about without necessarily just the influence of what's happened overnight in the US, the cost of UK government borrowing, and how much we've talked about that since the budget in particular, rose again yesterday, the effective cost of it, to 4.59%. If we're looking at the cost of borrowing for the UK over a 10-year period, those 10-year bonds. Is there still jitteriness about the UK's finances?
I think so. I mean, the bottom line is that, unfortunately, governments are going to have to issue more bonds everywhere, not just in the UK, in Europe, and indeed in the US. And so we have, unfortunately, the likelihood that actually the cost of government borrowing is going to remain high for some considerable period, even if we cut interest rates because there's a slowdown in economic growth. So from that point of view, yes, I think it's going to be quite a tension. And I think it's going to be a shortage of cash, which is why companies generating surplus cash like those in the UK are going to be better positioned relative to international comparatives.
Can I ask you about one of those businesses in the UK, AstraZeneca, sort of changing tack a little bit, but just seeing that major move in the massive pharmaceutical giant's share price yesterday, down 8%. What concerns has it got there?
Well, there have been anxieties about the Chinese sales they have. They've had one of their representatives been arrested in China. So from that point of view, there's real anxiety about how much Chinese sales go forward and whether there's price competition. I think many of these companies which actually generated very substantial profits, very substantial cash in the past, are going to come under massive pressure because governments just can't afford the price of drugs as they have been in the past.
And hearing Ronald Temple there talk about maybe changes to, you know, the electric vehicle market, despite Elon Musk's prominence in the Republican campaign, if, as investors seem to be expecting, Donald Trump goes on to win. Audi, I see their results, they're the latest car maker reporting a decline in sales and profits. What now for the car industry?
Well, I think it's going to be, I think we worry about, protectionism from the US coming. But actually, I think the problem is going to be even more significant with Europe. I think Europe's in the firing line for a change in regime in the US. And specifically, that's going to affect not just, cars. I think it's going to affect Airbus and aircraft industries. I think there'll be tariffs on there. There may even be tariffs on wine and other things. So coming back to it, I think companies like Audi, they've held up better than Volkswagen, but I think they're going to come under enormous pressure in terms of tariffs going forward and the ability of being in overcapacity at a time when, unfortunately, demand is under pressure.
Gervais, thanks so much. Gervais Williams, head of equities at Premier Miton.
Sean, thanks very much. At 26 minutes past six, Mike with the sport.
Emma, thank you. Good morning. There was nothing too close to call about last night's football after a couple of emphatic victories for British clubs in the Champions League.
Remember the 5th of November at Celtic Park, because Celtic, for the very first time in the Champions League, from a goal down to turn this one around against the German giants of RB Leipzig.
And Luis Diaz with his first hat-trick for Liverpool. That finishes the night. Diaz, the hat-trick hero. Liverpool four wins.
Four wins out of four for Liverpool in the Champions League this season. They currently sit top of the league table after a 4-0 victory over Bayer Leverkusen. Luis Diaz with a hat-trick at Anfield. Meanwhile, it was a famous night for Celtic. They came from behind to beat RB Leipzig 3-1 in Glasgow. It is a second win of the campaign for Brendan Rodgers' side, who have now given themselves a real chance of making the knockout stages.
Listen, we just want to be a competitive team at this level. There's been obviously a lot of criticism around the club at this level, but we want to be really competitive, make it really difficult for teams. And we can't look any further than that. It's a great performance. It was a great night for the football club, and we'll take that energy into our next games.
Elsewhere, Manchester City have suffered a third successive defeat for the first time since April 2018. After defeats in the Premier League and League Cup to Bournemouth and Tottenham respectively, Pep Guardiola's team were last night beaten 4-1 away to Sporting Lisbon.
We played really bad against Bournemouth. We played really good today. Emotion is difficult when we play the first half that we played, and after 2 minutes second half we are losing 3-1. It's not easy to swallow, but it's an experience, and I don't give up. Maybe people waiting, but I'm not give up. No, that's for sure.
Well, the win for Sporting Lisbon gave manager Ruben Amorim victory in his final home match in charge before he takes over at Manchester United. And elsewhere in the Champions League, back-to-back home defeats now for Real Madrid. The holders were beaten 3-1 by AC Milan at the Bernabeu last night. Madrid have now lost two of their first four games in this season's competition. And finally, cricket, England captain Ben Stokes has chosen to skip next year's Indian Premier League, but the former England bowler James Anderson has registered for the upcoming auction. England's leading wicket-taker Anderson, who retired from international duty in July, aged 42, has put his name forward alongside pace bowler Jofra Archer.
Mike, thanks very much.
Follow the outcome of the US election with Americast.
It's the BBC podcast full of lively chats about politics,
with social media investigations
and experts on the ground.
We'll guide you through all the key moments as the United States heads in its next direction.
Navigate your way through the US election.
Americast.
Listen on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Keep it here with us live for those results as they come in. 28 minutes past six. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb in Washington, DC and Emma Barnett here in London. And now a summary of the news from Vigialis.
Donald Trump is expected to address his supporters in Florida after making the first breakthroughs in the U.S. presidential election. He is projected to win the swing states of Georgia and North Carolina. Votes are being counted in the remaining five states where the outcome is uncertain: Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Nevada, and Arizona. There is a celebratory mood among Mr. Trump's supporters, while the atmosphere at the headquarters of his rival Kamala Harris is more subdued, and it's been announced she won't be addressing her supporters today. Her campaign has insisted that she can still win. Majorities in the House of Representatives and the Senate are also at stake. Around a third of the seats are being contested in the Senate, which is currently controlled by the Democrats. As votes continue to be counted, the Republicans look to gain control of the chamber. In the House, all 435 seats are up for grabs. The outcome is expected to be very close. Voters in Delaware made history by electing a Democrat, Sarah McBride, as the first openly transgender member of Congress. 10 U.S. states have also held ballots on abortion rights. Voters in Florida fell just short of enshrining fuller abortion rights in the state constitution. In Arizona, voters passed a constitutional amendment which extends the length of time a woman can get an abortion, with projections suggesting Missouri will do the same. In other news, police in Tel Aviv have used water cannon and horses to disperse thousands of people protesting against the dismissal of the defense minister, Yoav Gallant. The Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, said he'd sacked him because of what he called a crisis of trust. Mr. Gallant had argued for an end to hostilities in Gaza and a hostage deal, a view rejected by Mr. Netanyahu. A bird flu outbreak has been confirmed at a farm near Hornsey in Yorkshire. The government says all poultry at the site will be humanely culled and two control zones have been put in place around the farm.
Vigi, thank you. It is 29 minutes to seven. There is not yet a result here in Washington, D.C., but the picture at the moment is much happier for Donald Trump than it is for Kamala Harris. Donald Trump is expected to speak in his campaign headquarters any minute now, and Fox News has just projected that the battleground state of Pennsylvania is going to be won by him. They are saying he is only three electoral votes away from winning the presidency. The night started with the polls closing here on America's East Coast and predictions that there would be a record turnout.
Our coverage of election 2024 starts right now. People have been voting in record numbers. In fact, more than 85 million people voted early. And all reports today are that turnout is strong and we could see a record surpassing the more than 160 million who voted in the last presidential election.
The early results went as predicted, both Donald Trump and Kamala Harris winning the states they were expected to, including Donald Trump's home state of Florida, no longer a swing state, Florida cementing its place as solidly Republican.
And let's bring you some CNN projections. CNN projects that Donald Trump will win the state of Florida with its 30 electoral votes, as expected. Donald Trump, CNN projects, will win the state of Tennessee, as expected, with its 11 electoral votes. We have some projections for Kamala Harris as well. CNN projects that the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, with its 11 electoral votes, as expected, will go to Kamala Harris.
Before the polls had even closed, Donald Trump had posted about what he called possible election cheating in cities in key swing states, Philadelphia in Pennsylvania, Detroit in Michigan. He later actually called into a radio station in Wisconsin, another battleground state, where officials were recounting 30,000 ballots because voting machine doors hadn't been properly secured.
Milwaukee thing is a big thing, and I think they fortunately we caught it, and hopefully they'll do something about it. It's a lot of votes. And with respect to Detroit and you know, frankly, Philadelphia, I guess, is what we're talking about. It's just that's the rumor that's going around. People are talking about it. We can't let that happen. We just can't let that happen. If we let that happen, you know, we lose faith in our elections any more than we already have lost faith.
and the Republican city commissioner in Philadelphia said there was absolutely no truth to any allegations. It was another example, he said, of disinformation. But in a sense, then the legal side of this went away and the political came back. It was at 4:40 a.m. when the U.S. networks first projected the winner of one of the seven swing states, CNN, Fox and CBS, giving North Carolina to Donald Trump.
CNN has a major projection. CNN projects that Donald Trump will win the state of North Carolina. This is the first of seven battleground states that we're keeping an eye on, and we are calling it for Donald Trump.
Some calls in terms of the race for the White House in some very key battleground states, this one in North Carolina, going in favor of Trump.
CBS News projection for the battleground state of North Carolina and its 16 electoral votes. We can project that Trump will win North Carolina.
And then an hour later, the networks began declaring Georgia for Donald Trump, making Kamala Harris's path to victory vanishingly small.
This is NBC News projection in the state of Georgia. NBC News projects that Donald Trump will win in Georgia when all the votes are counted. There's the breakdown right now, 118,000 vote margin. But again, Donald Trump, the projected winner. This is a big call here on a night in which we've waited quite some time for some of these important battleground calls.
All eyes now on the rest of the swing states, particularly, of course, the Rust Belt. We'll hope to bring you news of those states, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania as well, throughout the program. But we can turn now at 25-7 to Donald Trump's headquarters and to Nada Torfik, our correspondent, who is there. He hasn't spoken yet, has he, Nada? And I can't see. I'm looking at pictures. I can't see him about to come out. But the mood, presumably, is hugely optimistic.
The prompters are set. The stage is set. Everyone is waiting to hear from Donald Trump. And yes, the mood is one of just absolute joy. People were milling about and chatting kind of throughout the night, but they have now congregated right in front of the stage. It's very packed in now in that area. And you mentioned Fox News projecting Donald Trump as the winner of Pennsylvania. Well, Fox News is playing here in the hall. And when that happened, people were quite literally jumping for joy, chanting USA. They clearly feel emboldened by this momentum. They feel that Donald Trump will ultimately be named the next president. So supporters that I've been going down to speak with and hear from say that they think everything he's done during this campaign has resonated with other Americans beyond his core base.
And obviously, we will bring him his speech live to people when he starts. But are we expecting that anytime soon? Is there a sense that he is about to speak?
You know, I spoke to the campaign because for a while we were told he's going to be speaking soon. They said perhaps, before 2 a.m., but they couldn't give me a set time. And I think that's typical Donald Trump, a little bit of unpredictability. They kind of take their direction from him and when he's ready to speak. So once we kind of get any further steer, but as I say, the prompters are set, the stage has been set, just waiting for him to step out.
And we were mentioning as well that the threats of legal action and of suggestions of fraud, etc., etc. If he has won pretty convincingly, that all goes away, presumably, now.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I spoke with some campaign officials about that, including Brian Lanza. I asked, Donald Trump is making these claims of fraud when officials, the district attorney in Pennsylvania, others were having to put out statements saying there was absolutely no evidence of a widespread fraud that would affect the election or any kind of violence out in the streets. In some places that he had suggested that. And I told them, what happens if he wins? What do you do about all these cases? And their stance is essentially two things can happen at once. He can win convincingly, and there could still be some electoral issues. Now, nobody is suggesting that there haven't been cases where lines have had to be extended for voters or there haven't been some tabulation software issues that were resolved, but nothing to this sense of wide-scale fraud. And I would assume Donald Trump will not necessarily feel the need to keep that narrative going.
Okay, Nada Taufik at Trump headquarters. Thank you.
Well, let's now at 22 minutes to 7 cross to Samira Hussein, our correspondent in the Harris headquarters in Washington, D.C. As people are waiting to hear what Donald Trump has to say, are we going to hear from Kamala Harris, Samira?
We most certainly will not be hearing from the vice president today. The co-chair of her campaign actually came up just a little while ago and told the audience that she will not be speaking today, but she eventually will be addressing her Howard family, speaking to Howard University, which is where we are right now. So you can actually tell that people have cleared out. It's quite quiet here. The murmur that you hear behind me is really just other media that are reporting what's not happening here. The people have left. The crowds were thinning before even they were told that the vice president wasn't going to be speaking. And it was such a difference from the atmosphere at the beginning of the night. There was thousands of people here. There was a DJ spinning tunes. People were dancing. It was a downright jovial atmosphere, people really believing that they were going to witness a momentous moment in American history. But as those vote tallies started coming in, I think that optimism had started to wane quite a bit. And in fact, people started leaving early, realizing that perhaps this is not the moment they were hoping for.
And what are the campaigns saying now, the Kamala Harris camp? Is there optimism still within there at this point, or what are we to take? What's the mood music?
Well, so the mood music really is, it's actually been quite silent. I think the Harris campaign is still trying to figure out what they're going to do next, even for us right now, you know, even trying to get guidance on what we should be doing going forward. They were not able to offer any of them. Look, they're probably trying to figure out what their next steps are going to be. And in some ways, that is somewhat emblematic of just how this campaign has been run. There have been moments that, you know, people were left wondering which direction they're going to go into. And I was actually speaking with one supporter who was surprised at some levels of disorganization in some parts of the country.
Samira Hussein, that's our correspondent coming from Kamala Harris HQ in Washington, D.C.
Time is 22:07, and I should say just briefly, Emma, that CBS News, our broadcast partners here in the United States, are saying that Pennsylvania, that crucial swing state on which everything was once thought to depend, but certainly still one of the crucial swing states, is leaning towards Donald Trump. So they're not calling it, but they're saying it's leaning towards him.
That's the direction of travel at the moment. It's 19 minutes to 7. So come to UK politics. Kemi Badenoch, the new Conservative leader, will face Keir Starmer for the first time today as leader of the opposition at Prime Minister's Questions. Ian Watson, our political correspondent, is here. There are many in her camp, in the Conservative Party, who are excited for this, it's safe to say.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. She's a new leader with a new style, Emma. I think it is going to be very interesting to watch her performance today, because I think the people who'll be watching most closely will not be so much the Labour government, it will be some of her own MPs, because don't forget, to get into that final ballot, which she won against Robert Jenrick, she had the support of just over a third of her MPs. So I think lots of people will be scrutinising closely the kind of performance that she gives. Now, as far as I'm aware, as you know, she is sometimes criticised for being abrasive, for being confrontational. But the kind of approach that I think she's going to take is the kind of approach that she adopted when she was shadowing Angela Rayner, and that was less confrontational and more mocking. What she would tend to do is actually say, look, the government's far more difficult than you might have thought. We might be here to, you know, help you out where we can, but actually you have difficulty delivering on your promises. So I think we might see a little bit of humour rather than just some ranting from the opposition benches today. I think also the difficulty for her, though, will be as somebody who campaigned without really talking about very much policy, will be what she does when she denounces anything Labour's doing. Plenty of ammunition from the budget, but what Labour will be doing is saying, look, OK, if you don't like this, what would you do instead? And try to tempt her into areas where there might be divisions in her own ranks.
Much of political watching today is across the pond, but we wanted to remember, Ian Watson, did we not? Thank you with your help. What's going on here in the UK with Kemi Badenoch today, making that first outing as leader of the opposition at PMQs?
Yeah, and at 17 minutes to 7, let us stick with UK politics and with what was happening yesterday in Parliament with our correspondent, Susan Hume.
It's been a long campaign. One man, one woman, locked in a titanic battle for power. But finally, it's over.
I've been a little busy over the summer.
Robert Jenrick, who lost out to Kemi Badenoch to be Conservative leader, was appearing in the Commons Chamber just hours after being appointed to his new role as Shadow Justice Secretary in her team. Later today, the Commons will be packed for Kemi Badenoch's first foray into Prime Minister's questions. But having come second, Robert Jenrick faced a far smaller crowd, a handful of MPs and a smattering of bemused schoolchildren in the public gallery. But he still took the fight to the government, saying he had noticed some things during his busy summer.
During that time, the only group whose popularity this Labour government's popularity has increased with is criminals. How many domestic abusers and sex offenders who were released under their early release scheme have gone on to reoffend? And would they like to apologise to the victims?
Squeaks of indignation there from Labour MPs. The early release of prisoners to free up space in jails began under the Conservatives. The Justice Minister, Alex Davis-Jones, bounced to her feet in high dudgeon.
Well, Mr Speaker, I was going to congratulate the Right Honourable Gentleman in his new role, but he seems to have a very short memory, and I believe it is he who should be apologising to the country as a whole on behalf of his government's woeful, absolute misabuse of our justice system and our prisons.
And she said that unlike the Conservative government, hers had put in exemptions to prevent sex offenders and domestic abusers being released. As part of his leadership campaign, Robert Jenrick had called for the UK to leave the 70-year-old treaty, the European Convention on Human Rights, the ECHR. Speaking for the Lib Dems, Josh Babarindi gave him a double-edged greeting.
I welcome the new Shadow Justice Secretary to his place. As someone whose campaigns withdraw from the ECHR, I'm sure we can rely on him to champion international law for all of us across the world.
But he also wanted to talk about domestic violence and the way in which perpetrators were often charged with common assault.
For too long, domestic abusers have been able to exploit a loophole in our legal system where the domestic abuse that they perpetrate is masked by the ambiguous conviction of common assault. And this has meant that domestic abusers under this government and indeed under the previous government have qualified for early release schemes.
And he wanted to see change to ensure that those criminals did not slip through the net and get released early. Labour's Ashley Dalton wanted more done about a related issue, stalking. She had a case in point.
My constituent, Dr Marie Javal, was a victim of stalking by a man she had a brief relationship with. He even put a tracker on her car without her knowledge. There were needless delays in her case, and she felt she wasn't taken seriously. So bad was the stress, her hair fell out. Later, it transpired that the investigating officer on her case was himself convicted of stalking a woman.
Turning to sentencing, a Conservative, Peter Bedford, reckoned there was a growing perception that some sentencing was politically motivated.
A lady from Northampton was recently given a 31-month sentence for a tweet, whereas an individual who incited physical violence on the streets of Birmingham as part of a pro-Palestinian protest received a far lesser sentence. Does the minister agree that these type of inconsistencies create the perception, at least, that we have a two-tier justice system?
Well, the Justice Secretary Shabana Mahmood answered this one herself, and she had a warning for MPs.
It's incumbent on members of this House to ensure that such a perception does not take hold and not inappropriately comparing sentences that are handed out in different types of cases.
She said Peter Bedford well knew that sentencing was a matter for independent judges who'd heard all the evidence in the trial.
And you can hear more on events on yesterday in Parliament at 9 o'clock on Radio 4 Extra. Susan Hume there. But at 13 minutes to 7, returning to the US political race in just a moment. But let's go to this, because 40% of households in England and Wales say they will struggle to afford higher water bills that will take effect from next April. That's according to a survey from the Consumer Council for Water, which the chief executive of which is here now, Mike Keel, who carried out that study. Mike, what can we learn from this survey?
Morning, Emma. We can learn quite a lot from this survey, because
it's quite frightening the extent to which water affordability is going to affect people in the future. You know, this survey is the biggest of its kind. We asked almost 10,000 water consumers across every single company in England and Wales. And what we saw is pretty bleak in terms of one in five households said they currently struggle with their water bills. And then when you present them with the future bill levels, that moves to two in five. That's almost 10 million households who are going to struggle to afford their water bill. And that's extremely concerning when you ask people, what are they going to do in response to that? You know, about a third of people who are concerned said they will cut back on essentials like food shopping in order to afford a water bill. That's a situation that we just can't let happen.
And yet it's the reality that's going to be facing people from next April, is it not?
That's absolutely right. And that's why we are calling for increased support for those who can't afford the water bill. Currently, each company offers what's called a social tariff. So that's a reduced rate if you're struggling with your bill. But that changes from company to company. And the support on offer can be vastly different, ranging from, you know, almost all of your bill reduced by 80%. In some companies, you might not get very much off your bill at all. So it's completely inconsistent. So what we are calling for is the current system to be revamped and replaced with a much more fairer system of social tariffs that is consistent across England and Wales, which means that everyone who is struggling can be assured that that safety net is in place, that support is there if they need it, and put an end to this postcode lottery.
But in terms of how would that actually happen, or how would that work?
Yeah, so a single social tariff would be funded from a central pot. So a levy on all water bills go into a central pot, and then that's redistributed where the need is greatest. And that point's really crucial, because currently each company with their own support schemes is just funded by other customers within their own company boundaries. But of course, as we all know, poverty isn't evenly distributed, and therefore those distributional effects would be quite significant. So some companies would just not be able to afford to sort the problem if it's done using the current method within the ring fence, within each company's guideline web boundaries. Water companies committed back in 2019 as part of a public interest commitment to end water poverty by 2030. And, you know, this single social tariff is the best way to do that. And we'd like to see every single water company stand by the commitment that they made back then. Because what's the point of having a public interest commitment if you're not going to do it when the going gets tough? So we'd like to see all companies stand by that.
The proposal is there. Let's see what will happen. And I'm sure we'll talk again. Mike Keel, Chief Executive of the Consumer Council for Water, that carried out that survey. Thank you.
9 minutes to seven. Welcome back to Washington, D.C., where I can see there is rapturous scenes at Donald Trump's headquarters in Florida, because Fox News has just said that it is now projecting that he becomes the 47th president of the United States. The other networks not doing that yet, but certainly it has been a night where his supporters have been celebrating and hers have been increasingly dejected. Among hers, I've been talking to Ben Rhodes, former Deputy National Security Advisor to President Obama. I asked him if he thinks there's any chance now that Kamala Harris could win.
I mean, she's obviously not conceded, but it does not look like there's a very clear path for her at this point.
And why is that? Who are the groups of voters who she thought would turn out for her, you thought would turn out for her, and didn't?
Well, I mean, there'll be plenty of time to dig into the data, but I think, you know, what's clear is that Trump made gains in a number of areas. Certainly, it appears like he made pretty significant gains with, you know, Latino men, who in the past have been, you know, pretty solidly Democratic. You know, made some inroads with other demographics, but just generally, you know, the Trump case was that people were in an anti-incumbent mood, were upset about the economy, were not happy with the 4 years of the Biden presidency, and that he had a message that was resonating with, you know, men in particular, and that the, you know, whatever gains she had with women or more educated voters on issues like abortion, clearly, you know, that was not enough to compete with the gains that, you know, Trump made with an electorate that is just, you know, not in a good mood and is in an anti-incumbent mood.
You're a foreign affairs specialist. Final thought about Ukraine and what happens now. And Donald Trump has made all sorts of claims about what he could do now, but he hasn't been at all clear, has he, in any kind of detail?
He's not. He's avoided any detail. I kind of expect the worst, you know, when it comes to foreign affairs, because I think the important thing for people to understand is the first time around, he was mainly surrounded by fairly conventional figures, right? Jim Mattis at Secretary of Defense, H.R. McMaster as his national security advisor, even a John Bolton, who I don't agree with about, you know, just about anything, you know, was a more recognizable Republican figure as national security advisor. You know, this time around, I think Trump is going to have people that are much more aligned with his kind of America first worldview. The kinds of, you know, the selection of J.D. Vance, for instance, as vice president is an indicator. This is a man who's been, you know, among the most outspoken people in the United States Congress against aid to Ukraine. So I think we're heading into a period of, you know, American retrenchment from alliances, probably retrenchment from support for Ukraine, and a kind of transactionalism in great power relationships.
That was Ben Rhodes talking to me just a few moments ago. Donald Trump still expected to speak to his supporters very soon, but he hasn't yet appeared. Let's talk to John Zogby, the veteran independent pollster who is in New York. Morning to you, John.
Hi, Justin.
It looks, doesn't it, pretty firmly now as if Kamala Harris has lost and Donald Trump has won.
Yeah, there is, I think, virtually no path to victory for her. I'm looking at the states that have not been called just yet, but with the amount of votes that have been counted already, you know, she's down by 3-4 percentage points in some of those tight battleground states. And it's hard to see geographically how she makes those up. So I think it's pretty certain.
And are the exit polls giving us any clue as to why that is? What has happened?
Well, you know, ditto pretty much everything Ben Rhodes just said. She did very well among women. The reproductive rights was a very important issue for young women and older women as well. But she underperformed Joe Biden's turnout and figures from 2020. And that's why, you know, Biden won Georgia. She lost Georgia. The biggest clue for me was when she lost North Carolina, even though Biden had won that in 2020. That was a severe blow to her because polls were indicating that she had a real shot there. But this turned out to be the men versus the women, I think particularly young men versus young women. You know, you had a huge gender gap between those two, almost 70 percentage points between young men and how they voted and view their world versus young women, the same thing. She made inroads among, or he made inroads among blacks, still not a lot of votes from blacks, but young black men voted for him, you know, more than one in four.
John, is it possible as well that he wins an actual majority of the electorate, which wouldn't have been expected? But it does seem, doesn't it, that in some of the states that he hasn't won, I'm thinking of New York, possibly California, that he's actually done better than was expected in those places, and that might give him a majority.
That's very true. You know, Joe Biden had a 5 million vote plurality margin, I should say, in California. It looks to that's 2020. It looks to me like her margin of victory in California is about 3 million. Well, yeah, had she been able to match Joe Biden's output, that would have been enough to have tightened the race and brought Donald Trump perhaps under 50%. But it does look like it could be. Not ready to say it just yet, but it could be a majority for Donald Trump. And that is a mandate.
John Zogby, independent pollster, thank you so much for staying up for us. We appreciate your time.
3 minutes to seven. This afternoon, we've got a new series for you.
The Law Show on BBC Radio 4, discussing the legal issues behind the headlines and explaining how law impacts all our lives. Each episode, we delve into the most pressing legal questions of our time, from property to education, from family to housing.
by listening into our show, you gain a new understanding into the law, which affects all of us. The new series of The Law Show with me, Dr. Joelle Grogan, starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds this afternoon at 3.
At 2 minutes to seven, let's get the latest on the weather from Simon King. Simon, hello.
Morning, Emma. It's more of the same weather-wise, I have to say, across the UK. Lots of clouds, mist and some fog this morning, which is going to gradually lift up and clear away. And for much of southern England, through Wales, the Midlands, eastern England, the mist and fog clears. It's going to stay pretty cloudy all day, really, but light winds, so it's pretty calm. And it feels quite mild, actually. Temperatures this morning, mostly in double figures, and by this afternoon, 13 to 15 degrees Celsius. But we could even see the odd 16, 17 degrees to the north of high ground in Devon and Wales. Across northern England and Northern Ireland, again, mist and fog should mostly clear. Lots of low cloud around. There may be a few breaks in that cloud developing across parts of northeast England, but for most, there'll be very little change in the weather that you've got outside your window at the moment. Temperatures 13 to 15 degrees. Locally, perhaps 16, 17 degrees in Northern Ireland. And across Scotland, well, it's chilly in the northeast of Scotland. Temperatures here close to freezing. That's because we've got clear skies, and that's where we'll have some sunshine today. But elsewhere, again, really quite cloudy with temperatures of 13 to 16 Celsius.
Thank you very much for that, Simon. Much more to come, of course, in the next hour about the US election and the results, which were expected to be close, but perhaps have not been as close as they were expected to be. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett in London and Justin Webb in our studio in Washington, D.C. It's 7 o'clock on Wednesday, the 6th of November. The headlines this morning: Donald Trump is expected to speak in the next few minutes after the US TV network Fox News called the presidential election for him. No other network has called it so far. The results are still coming in, but he has made the first breakthrough in the crucial swing states which will decide the next US president. He's projected to take both North Carolina and Georgia. There are indications he may also capture Pennsylvania. The Democrats are increasingly anxious. Kamala Harris has said she will not be addressing her supporters today. As the polls began to close, I went to parties for both candidates here in Washington, D.C.
I'm feeling very, very strong because the fact is that Trump always overperforms polls.
Madam President, she will be the next president of the United States, and I can count on it. So I'm really glad to be here.
Donald Trump is expected to speak to his supporters in Florida soon. Kamala Harris's campaign says she will address the nation later today.
We'll keep looking at what this then means for the rest of the world as perhaps the picture becomes even clearer. And Benjamin Netanyahu's biographer will be on the programme to say why the Israeli Prime Minister has sacked his defence minister, unpack that some more, and what that means for his war strategy. And the BBC News is read by Vijay Alice.
Donald Trump appears to be gaining momentum in his battle to be re-elected to the White House after he was projected to win two of the seven states which are crucial to the result. Our U.S. partner, CBS, has projected that the former president will win the southern states of Georgia and North Carolina, and it now says that the crucial northern state of Pennsylvania is also leaning his way. Our North America editor, Sarah Smith, has just sent this report.
After a long, tense and acrimonious campaign, it looks as though Donald Trump has won the race. Before midnight, the first of the key battleground states, North Carolina, was projected to be won by the former president. Then the state of Georgia, too, was added to his column of expected victories, and the direction of the night became apparent. At the Kamala Harris HQ event in Washington, her campaign chair, Cedric Richmond, came out to tell her supporters their candidate was not coming to speak to them. A clear sign they thought she was on course to lose.
We still have votes to count. We still have states that have not been called yet. We will continue overnight to fight to make sure that every vote is counted, that every voice has spoken. So you won't hear from the Vice President tonight, but you will hear from her tomorrow.
Immediately, the large, depressed and dejected crowd emptied out of the venue, while at the same time excitement was building at the Donald Trump party in West Palm Beach in Florida. Some TV networks are also saying they expect Mr. Trump to win the biggest and most important swing state of Pennsylvania. If that projection is correct, it puts him on the verge of victory. If he wins, this is the most dramatic comeback in American political history. A man who, when he was ejected from the White House 4 years ago, refused to accept the result and watched his supporters violently attack the Capitol in an attempt to keep him in power. Who has since been indicted in 4 criminal cases and convicted in one of them, yet has now won re-election by what looks like it may be a bigger margin than his original victory in 2016.
Our correspondent Gary O'Donoghue spent the night at Donald Trump's campaign headquarters in Florida as the results unfolded and sent this report.
The anticipation has grown throughout the night here, the crowd increasingly believing that Donald Trump is on his way to a second term in the White House. Thousands of invited guests watched the big screens as the results poured in, cheering every state called in favour of the former president. But this is by no means over until the votes in those key swing states are finally counted. However, those in the crowd were oozing confidence.
It's looking good. It's looking good. Trump's going to take it. And we're going to take the Senate and the House.
We go to the White House and we save America.
While the outcome of this election is not certain, it's undoubtedly the case that Kamala Harris's path to victory has become a narrow one. The Trump campaign is feeling very confident.
The mood at Kamala Harris's headquarters in Washington, D.C. changed markedly when the results went against her. Our correspondent Michelle Fleury is there.
Supporters came to Howard University expecting a party. Instead, after all the nervousness, anxiety and trepidation, there was a growing sense of disappointment as swing states like North Carolina and Georgia tipped in Donald Trump's favour. The crowds evaporated almost immediately after it became clear Kamala Harris wouldn't be speaking tonight at the historic black college that she once attended. Others chose to remain optimistic that there was still a path for one of their own to win the presidency. We'll soon discover whether the apprehension or the optimism are justified.
The Republicans are projected to have gained Senate seats in Ohio and West Virginia, which would give them control of the chamber in the House of Representatives, where the Republicans are on course to retain their majority. All 435 seats are up for grabs. Our North America correspondent Peter Bowes has the details.
The balance of power in Congress can make or break a new president's aspirations to bring about change in America. With votes still being counted, the Republicans are projected to win the Senate after gaining 2 seats. The Texan Ted Cruz, a close ally of Donald Trump, held his seat after a strong campaign by a Democratic challenger. The Republicans have also picked up a seat in the House, but it's too early to call the final result. In Delaware, voters made history electing Sarah McBride, a Democrat, as the first openly transgender member of Congress. In a notable governor's race, the Democratic candidate in North Carolina defeated a Republican who's been mired in controversy over comments he's alleged to have made on a pornographic website.
10 U.S. states have also held ballots on abortion rights. Voters in Florida fell just short of enshrining fuller abortion rights in the state constitution. In Arizona, voters passed a constitutional amendment which extends the length of time a woman can get an abortion, with projections suggesting Missouri will do the same. The initiatives were in response to the Supreme Court's decision in 2022 to overturn a longstanding judgment which gave women the constitutional right to abortion. The FBI says its name and logo have been used in several false messages about the election. The agency also said hoax bomb threats were directed at polling stations in swing states, including Georgia, Michigan, and Wisconsin. It said the threats appeared to come from Russia. The Russian embassy in Washington called the allegations malicious slander. In other news, thousands of Israelis have taken to the streets to protest against the dismissal of the defense minister, Yoav Gallant. Police in Tel Aviv used water cannon and horses to disperse them. Mr. Gallant was sacked by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu last night because of what he called a crisis of trust. Our correspondent Joe Inwood reports from Jerusalem.
Yoav Gallant and Benjamin Netanyahu have long had a difficult relationship. It is now broken. The now former defense minister said his desire to compromise and get a hostage deal, to make ultra-Orthodox Jews serve in the military, and the need for an inquiry into the October the 7th attacks were behind his dismissal. The Prime Minister said trust had cracked between the pair. Water cannon and horses were used to disperse protesters who took to the street overnight. Yoav Gallant will be replaced by Israel Katz, thought to be even more hawkish on the current conflict.
And some news just in. The BBC's US partner CBS News has projected Donald Trump has won Pennsylvania. Government officials say a case of bird flu has been confirmed at a site near Hornsey in East Yorkshire. Some restrictions have been put in place and poultry at the infected premises is being culled. Here's Will Vernon.
Avian flu is an infectious virus that spreads among birds, and in rare cases, it can be passed on to humans. The UK saw dozens of outbreaks on poultry farms last year, but no one became ill. Earlier this year, Britain declared itself bird flu free. Now, officials say there's been a new outbreak and all poultry at the site will be humanely culled. Two control zones will be put in place, although the restrictions only apply to those who keep poultry, such as farmers. The latest government advice on bird flu says the risk to the public remains very low.
There's a warning that 40% of households in England and Wales may struggle to afford higher water bills from April. The estimate is based on a survey of 9,500 people for the Consumer Council for Water. The regulator, Ofwat, has proposed allowing water companies to increase bills by 21% above inflation over the next 5 years to raise money to tackle leaks and sewage pollution.
Vijay, thank you. 9 minutes past seven is the time. We are expecting to hear from Donald Trump in Florida any moment now. But before we do, let us turn to the Republican former congressman, Jake LaTourneur. He's just retired from Congress, who is here in our Washington, D.C. studio. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
What
Thanks
a
for having me.
Staggering comeback for Donald Trump.
It's a crazy night, honestly. We did not know what would happen. Everything was tied. Everything was close. And the truth of the matter is when you take a step back and look at it, it does make more sense than it seems. Kamala Harris had a lot of headwinds. And what I mean by that is that over two thirds of the American people think that we're heading in the wrong direction. Joe Biden had an approval rating in the high 30s or low 40s. There has not been a vice president elected immediately after their boss in the last 90 years, other than George H.W. Bush in 1988, and Ronald Reagan had an approval rating in the 60s. So she had a lot of headwinds. And then the biggest issues that people cared about, the economy and immigration, Trump had an edge on both of those. So if you take a step back and look at it, it makes some sense. But going into this, it seemed like a deadlock, very tied. And so, no, it is surprising.
Yeah. And right across the board, too. So we talked a lot about the swing states. What's really striking overnight is that it appears to be doing very well in the non-swing states as well, including in states where Kamala Harris has won. But Donald Trump has really reduced Democratic majorities to the extent we were hearing from a pollster just before 7 o'clock, to the extent that he might win the popular vote.
He might win the popular vote, exactly right. And what's so difficult for some people to understand is that it is not as though all of these tens of millions of Americans like everything that Donald Trump says or like everything that Donald Trump does. But for many of them, particularly the first-time voters, they feel for the first time in their life somebody is willing to fight for them. Somebody is going to disrupt the system. They've never felt like a politician understood them, spoke like them, used the same vernacular that might be a little crude, definitely not what polite society wants to hear at the cocktail party, but that's how a lot of folks speak. And so it's surprising, but for a lot of folks, they felt right at home with Donald Trump, and they felt like he was going to deliver on the economy and on immigration.
And if he is president again now, and we're not saying for certain that he is, but it does look highly likely, and Fox News is projecting that he is going to be the 47th president of the United States, he will have the Senate on his side,
yes,
won't he? We don't yet know about the House of Representatives, but if they also stay with the Republicans, because there is already a majority there, that is a clean sweep. That makes him very powerful.
It sure does. The House is, it is too early to call that. I feel confident Donald Trump will be the next president. I feel confident the Senate, that's not really even a question. The Senate will go into Republican hands. The House, though, where I currently serve, I'm a little more anxious about. Only because we were outspent so much across the country. And Donald Trump was effectively able to create space between himself and the abortion issue that is so big in the United States. In a lot of these House races, candidates were not able to do that, and they were outspent. And so it's going to be days and perhaps weeks until we know who has the majority in the House.
If he has one, what does it say about the modern United States? Because it one of the fascinating things, yes, he will have won white people. He certainly will have won non-college educated white people. But he's made significant roads into other groups, other communities, hasn't he? Which the Democrats are shocked by.
In the exit polling that I saw, he won the white vote by less than he did in 2020 when he lost. The reason he's winning this election is because he is winning with young people. Yeah, and by winning, I mean he's losing by less in some of these instances, to be clear. But he's doing better with young people, particularly young men. He's doing much better with Hispanics, and he's doing much better with the black vote. And so it is confusing, but he has worked meticulously to lean into these particular demographics. If you look at his media strategy, the big time media outlets that every presidential candidate has done for years and years and cycles, he didn't do. He didn't do the big 60 Minutes interview mm-hmm. that every president has done. He did Joe Rogan's podcast. He did Theo Vaughn's podcast. He did, Dave Ramsey, like this is not a normal media strategy, but they decided we are going to meet people where they are. We're going to be innovative. We're going to be creative. And it's a weird thing. I'm a young guy, but I've been in politics a long time. And so when I see a new media strategy like this, I instantly get nervous. Because I think, for goodness sakes, what are you doing on a podcast? But the truth of the matter is the person that holds Walter Cronkite's seat, the CBS Evening News, is getting far fewer viewers than does Joe Rogan, right?
It is a fascinating point. That Congressman Jake LaTourneur, thank you so much
for taking
the time to talk to us this morning. And I should say, we are still waiting for Donald Trump to speak. There is some quite frantic activity around the podium, but no sign at the moment of him, although I think that probably will change over the next few minutes.
Indeed. Microphones being adjusted. Well, we can adjust ours to listen to our BBC North America editor, Sarah Smith, as our sister network CBS now projecting a Trump win in Pennsylvania. Sarah, what can you tell us?
Well, that puts him so close to the magic 270 votes that it seems inconceivable that he won't be elected the next president of the United States. Taking Pennsylvania doesn't quite do it. It leaves him just a handful of votes short, but he does seem to be leading in actually every single one of those seven key swing battleground states that we have spent so many weeks talking about, that we were telling our listeners again and again we're on an absolute knife edge and too close to call. Well, it appears that Donald Trump has outperformed expectations, possibly in every single one of them, and won a convincing victory to put him back in the White House. It's not certain yet, but it's also possible that, unlike in 2016 when he won the White House, he may also have won the popular vote. He may have won a majority of all of the Americans who voted in this election, which would be an absolutely stunning achievement for somebody, given how close we were saying this was all the way through.
And there will be, we understand, nothing from Kamala Harris at the moment. No speech expected imminently.
No, I'm at the Kamala Harris HQ, what would have been the victory party had things gone very, very differently. And that's what all the people who came here tonight were expecting. But after we heard the result from the first swing state, from North Carolina, that was projected to go to Donald Trump. Shortly after that, the chair of her campaign came out onto the stage that they had built for her to come out and declare victory. Instead, he came out rather sheepishly and said to the large assembled crowd that even though they were still waiting for every last vote to be counted and every last state to be declared, she would not be coming to talk to them that evening, and that she will address the nation at some point on Wednesday. And basically, the whole place emptied out within minutes. People who, only 2 or 3 hours beforehand had been dancing around, waving flags, full of excitement and expectation. They were so deflated and dejected. They just quickly evacuated this area.
Where is she now, Kamala Harris?
in her official vice presidential residence, the Naval Observatory, as it's known, in Washington, D.C.
Right, OK. It was interesting. I was speaking to one of her friends and political colleagues earlier, who was saying she had dinner with her husband and family, and that was when she was expected to speak. It's just interesting to picture where she is at the moment, and as we await Donald Trump to address his crowds and to speak publicly, and having that lectern readied for the former president, who, as you say, on the brink of presidency again. Just to put to you, Sarah, it may be too soon to say, but we've heard from a few pollsters so far on the programme about why this and how this victory has potentially happened for Donald Trump. Is it too simplistic to say it's men versus women on that front? Because we heard one of those strands of narrative coming through.
Well, men versus women was supposed to be the story that was going to give victory to Kamala Harris. That was what her campaign thought, was that women were going to come out in very, very large numbers to support her. And that was what was going to push her over the edge. In fact, I think, I mean, on the issues, it seems very clear that it is just simply about the economy. Well, not purely about the economy, but that was the issue uppermost in voters' minds. And there was a very clear answer to the question that Donald Trump asked at the beginning of every single one of his recent rallies, which was, do you feel better off now than you did 4 years ago? And the answer was no. Almost every person in America would say the answer to that was no, as a result of the high inflation that there has been over the last few years. If that was uppermost in your mind, then, you know, voters had very good reason to go and support Donald Trump. If we look at some of the demographics, it does appear that, as his campaign had been predicting all along, that he did make some significant inroads with Latino voters, with black voters, particularly men. You're looking at districts where Democrats could normally count on huge, reliable majorities being eaten into. Now, that's not to say that a majority of Latinos or black voters supported Donald Trump. Not at all. Kamala Harris still won large majorities of them. But enough of them crossed the aisle to vote for Donald Trump that it made the difference in several of these key swing states. And so, yeah, we'll drill down into this when we get some more of the data. But he does seem to have sold a very, very successful message on the economy and on immigration. And those were the things that voters cared about the most.
We'll be talking again. Our BBC North America editor, Sarah Smith, there.
20 past seven. Let's turn to Pennsylvania and to Tom Bateman, our correspondent, who is in its biggest city, Philadelphia. What can you tell us, Tom?
Well, we were in a pub which was hosting a lot of people who were watching this over on two floors throughout the night, watching the live coverage. We've just been turfed out. It's 2:15 in the morning, and there is really sort of no mood left in this city, which overwhelmingly votes Democrat in these very densely populated parts of Philadelphia. As it began, it was becoming clear by around midnight that the numbers just weren't working out for her across this state. I mean, she needed to, even in Philadelphia, breach in the very densely populated parts of this city more than 80% of the vote. And Joe Biden had managed that back in 2020 to counteract the very, very large majorities that Donald Trump was getting in the rural parts of Pennsylvania, these huge swathes of this state. And it was becoming clear, really, within the last couple of hours, it just wasn't happening for her. And then we had, as you know, in the last sort of 10 minutes, the state being projected for Donald Trump.
Yeah, and projected for Donald Trump because in the place where you are, Philadelphia, as you say, an overwhelmingly Democratic city, but a city that didn't turn out crucially in the kind of numbers for her that it needed to. And that seems to be a national picture, actually, Tom, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And when you start to look at what she needed to do, particularly if you look at the sort of, you know, they call them these collar counties, these suburban areas around Pennsylvania, where the big tactic for Kamala Harris was to target suburban women in particular on the issue of abortion, reproductive rights, particularly some of those sort of more moderate Republicans that might, the campaign thought, usually vote Republican, but just sort of flinched at Donald Trump and particularly didn't like his approach to abortion. But it just seems they haven't cut through in the way they wanted. And when we were looking at some of the exit polling, the numbers for women in parts of this state were above 50%, but just not far enough above 50% to get Kamala Harris into the kind of area she needed to be to win the state overall. So it does feel like the strategic approach they were taking hasn't worked for them, not just, as you say, in Pennsylvania, but across this country.
Tom Bateman in Philadelphia. Thank you.
7:23. Just as of after last week, today's the turn of Marks and Spencer to announce another increase of profits, turning our attention to UK business, but not without some concerns about the impact of that budget. Sean Farrington's back with more. Sean, hello again.
Hi, Emma. Yeah, just as we thought we might start hearing less of the word uncertain from businesses, the chief exec of M&S saying this morning the impact of the budget on customers and suppliers is for now uncertain. But at the same time, the business profits in the 6 months to the end of September up 20% to £392 million, more than expected as well. Zoe Gillespie is investment manager at RBC Brewin Dolphin. Morning, Zoe. What's driving this latest success?
Good morning. Yeah, well, I think from the narrative, we saw that the last results, it was the title, the beginning of the new M&S, and I think it's reshaping for growth. And as you see, I think we've seen food sales again coming in strong, up 8%. And I think the turnaround in clothing has helped too, with clothing and home sales up 4.7%. So the strategy of closing the less profitable, larger stores in favour of these more kind of smaller, more robust food stores seems to be certainly helping with profitability. And as you say, the profit, strategy profit for tax is up to nearly 20%. So all in all, seems a good set of results for Marks and Spencers.
Hearing retailers say the budget has created this uncertainty for them, do you think that will change the M&S approach at all?
Well, I think like everything, we saw it yesterday with AB Foods mentioning it, but So they've said that the budget has created some uncertainty, and it's whether we're going to see some cost increases and how they absorb that, and it's whether we're going to see some more efficiencies or whether the increased cost will have an impact on profitability. So I think that's something we'll see feed through to results coming through in the coming sort of 6 months to a year.
Okay, Zoe, we're going to have to leave it there. Zoe Gillespie, thank you very much from RBC Brewin Dolphin.
And Sean, you are leaving it there because at 7:25, Donald Trump is approaching the podium. In fact, he's stopped for a second to salute the crowd at his headquarters in Florida. His wife is next to him, many of his campaign staff behind him, and he's just standing there. Let's listen to him as he comes towards the podium. To the hills of Tennessee, across the plains of Texas, from sea to shining sea, from Detroit down to Houston, and New York to LA, where there's pride in people in the crowd. American heart, and it's time. Here we go. The family are in place. His vice president and his vice president's family as well behind him. And once everyone is in place and the music is faded down, Donald Trump is going to address his rapturous supporters. He's in no hurry to do so, I should say, because he is very obviously thoroughly enjoying this moment, this extraordinary political comeback. Whereas we've been saying during the course of the programme, not only is he the likely winner of this election, but with a majority of the popular vote, potentially, which would itself be an absolutely extraordinary fact. He's pointing at the crowd, and the music is going down in a second, I think. No, it's not. He's looking away again. As other members of the crowd arrive, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Republican Speaker, I can see there. And I think he's preparing to speak, but he keeps preparing to speak and then turning away as if, no, he's going to leave it a bit longer. He's enjoying this moment. Here we go.
Thank you very much. Wow. Well, I want to thank you all very much. This is great. These are our friends. We have thousands of friends in this incredible movement. This was a movement like nobody's ever seen before. And frankly, this was, I believe, the greatest political movement of all time. There's never been anything like this in this country and maybe beyond. And now it's going to reach a new level of importance because we're going to help our country heal. We're going to help our country heal. We have a country that needs help, and it needs help very badly. We're going to fix our borders. We're going to fix everything about our country. And we made history for a reason tonight, and the reason is going to be just that. We overcame obstacles that nobody thought possible, and it is now clear that we've achieved the most incredible political thing. Look what happened. Is this crazy? But it's a political victory that our country has never seen before, nothing like this. I want to thank the American people for the extraordinary honor of being elected your 47th president and your 45th president. And to every citizen, I will fight for you, for your family, and your future. Every single day, I will be fighting for you, and with every breath in my body. I will not rest until we have delivered the strong, safe, and prosperous America that our children deserve and that you deserve. This will truly be the golden age of America. That's what we have to have. This is a magnificent victory for the American people that will allow us to make America great again. And in addition to having won the battleground states of North Carolina, I love these places, Georgia, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, we are now winning in Michigan, Arizona, Nevada, and Alaska, which would result in us carrying at least 315 electoral votes. But it's much easier doing what the networks did or whoever called it, because there was no other path. There was no other path to victory. We also have won the popular vote. That was great. Very proud of it. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Now, winning the popular vote was very nice. Very nice, I will tell you. It's a great feeling of love. We have a great feeling of love in this very large room with unbelievable people standing by my side. These people have been incredible. They've made the journey with me, and we're going to make you very happy. We're going to make you very proud of your vote. I hope that you're going to be looking back someday and say that was one of the truly important moments of my life when I voted for this group of people beyond the president, this group of great people. America has given us an unprecedented and powerful mandate. We have taken back control of the Senate. Wow, that's good. And the Senate races in Montana, Nevada, Texas, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, the great Commonwealth of Pennsylvania were all won by the MAGA movement. They helped so much. And in those cases, every one of them, we worked with the senators. They were tough races, and I mean, the number of victories in the Senate was absolutely incredible. And we did tele-rallies. We did tele-rallies with each one of them. And sometimes we did two or three and it was amazing to look at all of those victories. Nobody expected that. Nobody. So I just wanted to thank you very much for that. And you have some great senators and some great new senators. And it also looks like we'll be keeping control of the House of Representatives. And I want to thank Mike Johnson. I think he's doing a terrific job. Terrific job. I want to also thank my beautiful wife, Melania, First Lady. Who has the number one best-selling book in the country. Can you believe that? Oh, no, she's done a great job, works very hard to help people. So I just want to thank her. But I want to thank my whole family, my amazing children, and they are amazing children. Now, we all think our children are amazing. Everybody here thinks their children are amazing, but that's a good thing when you think they are. But Don, Eric, Ivanka, Tiffany, Barron, Laura, Jared, Kimberly, Michael, thank you all. What a help. What a great. My father-in-law, Victor, is tremendous, and we miss very much Melania's mother, Amalia. We miss Amalia, don't we, huh? She would be very happy right now, standing on this stage. She'd be so proud. She was a great woman, that one. Beautiful inside and out. She was a great woman. I want to be the first to congratulate our great, now I can say, Vice President-elect of the United States, J.D. Vance. And his absolutely remarkable and beautiful wife, Usha Vance. And he is a feisty guy, isn't he? You know, I've said, go into the enemy camp.
There we are, Donald Trump speaking to his supporters. You're hearing him live at his campaign headquarters in Florida. He said he was going to help the country heal. He said every citizen, he was going to fight for them. He said America was going to be strong, safe and prosperous. He said it was going to be a golden age. He hasn't yet mentioned his opponent, Kamala Harris, though you heard him there mentioning his vice president, who we assume is going to be vice president because we are, as he was, assuming that he is now going to be the 47th president of the United States. In fact, I can see him now shaking hands with his vice president and welcoming him to the podium. Much more on all of this in just a moment. But first, at 25 to 8, let us have a summary of the news from Vigialis.
In the past few minutes, Donald Trump has addressed his supporters in Florida and declared what he called the most magnificent victory in the U.S. presidential election. He promised to fix and heal the country, saying he'd been handed an unprecedented and powerful mandate. Mr. Trump's speech came after projections showed he was edging closer to securing another term as president. He's won the swing states of Georgia, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. Outcomes are uncertain in the remaining four swing states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Nevada, and Arizona. Mr. Trump currently has 266 votes in the Electoral College. That's just four below the threshold for victory. At the headquarters of his rival, Kamala Harris, her supporters have dispersed after they were told she wouldn't be addressing them today. The Republicans are also projected to have secured a majority in the U.S. Senate. They have won two seats that were previously held by Democrats in West Virginia and Ohio. In the House of Representatives, the Republicans have picked up two seats, but it's still too early to call the final result. All 435 seats in the House are up for grabs. 10 states have also held ballots on abortion rights. Voters in Florida fell just short of enshrining fuller abortion rights in the state constitution. In Arizona, a constitutional amendment which extends the length of time a woman can get an abortion was approved. Bitcoin has risen by about 8% in response to a possible Trump victory. At one point, the cryptocurrency surged to an all-time high of more than $75,000. Traders think a Trump presidency would be more friendly towards easing cryptocurrency regulations. And police in Tel Aviv have used a water cannon and horses to disperse thousands of people protesting against the dismissal of the defense minister, Yoav Gallant. The Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, said he'd sacked him because of what he called a crisis of trust. Mr. Gallant had argued for a hostage deal, a view rejected by Mr. Netanyahu.
Vijay, thank you. It is 23 minutes to 8. Let us turn to Sarah Smith, our North America editor, who is on the line. It is looking now pretty certain that Donald Trump is going to be the 47th president of the United States. He was very certain, wasn't he, when we were listening to him just a second or two ago, and that he has won the Senate, which I think is right. And he says he'll win the House of Representatives, though we don't yet know if that's true.
We don't know if that's true, but it is looking as though there is every possibility that he will have won the White House, the Senate, and the House of Representatives, a full sweep, which will give him the opportunity to not only do what he can with his presidential power from the White House, but very possibly pass any legislation he wishes through Congress. It's very unusual for a president to control all branches of government like this, but it appears Donald Trump may very well be able to do that. So when he was saying in his speech there that this is an unprecedented and historic victory, this was for once not hyperbole from Donald Trump. It is absolutely true that he appears to have won a resounding victory. He may very well have won the popular vote as well, which he didn't do in 2016, and America seems to have given him a very clear mandate to enact what he was talking about on the campaign trail, some of which will be quite dramatic.
We've been saying for months, actually, but certainly in the last few days, that it was close, that the polls suggested it would be close. Were the polls wrong, or has it actually been close, but always breaking for him?
I think that's closer to the truth, because although the polls were saying it was, you know, 1% here, 2% there, given the margin of error that there is in most of them of about 3%, it was always entirely possible that they could be sort of roughly correct. But as you say, if everything broke in Donald Trump's favor, then he would be able to sweep all of those swing states. We don't yet know if he has won every single one of the seven battleground states, although it is looking quite positive for him in each and every single one of them. And of course, it was always possible that he could win the popular vote as well without the polls being desperately wrong. Although that said, in 2016 and in 2020, the other two presidential elections in which he ran, the polls did consistently undercount support for Donald Trump. And they said they had adjusted to account for that this time, but it may be that it is difficult for pollsters to get to all the Donald Trump supporters that there are and count them accurately. We'll need to take a little bit of time to dig further into the figures, but yeah, if everything goes his way as it appears it has, he could come out with this really, really very convincing victory.
As you say, it'll take a bit of time to dig into all the figures. But one thing that is already really striking from the exit polls, isn't it, is that Latino voters have supported him in proportions that may be historic.
Yes. There have been arguments that the Democrats had taken Latino voters for granted for a long time, but also that they didn't really understand the issues that second, third generation Latinos living in America cared about. Democrats for a long time have assumed that if they talk about immigration, that they talk about not wanting to be too strict on immigration, allowing a pathway to citizenship for illegal immigrants who are in the United States, for instance, allowing more to come in, that this is something that would be welcomed by the Latino community. But of course, voters who have been here for generations, who were born here, who speak English at home, who consider themselves to be Americans as well as Latinos, don't necessarily want to see a loose border policy or it being easier for other immigrants to come into the country. They take the very same view as a lot of other demographics in America on this, and it could have been a very big mistake from Democrats to assume that they can win Latino votes when they hear somebody like Donald Trump being very harsh on immigration. And of course, you know, he uses very rude terms, talking about all the people coming into America illegally being rapists and criminals, having been released from lunatic asylums in other countries. He even talked about immigrants poisoning the blood of America. And it was assumed that that would get a very negative reaction from Latino voters. But it appears that that's a big misunderstanding on behalf of the Democrats when it comes to that particular section of the electorate.
Sarah, we've just been listening to Donald Trump. Are we going to hear from Kamala Harris at all?
Well, when her campaign chair came out a couple of hours ago at the Harris HQ event I was at, he said that she was not going to come and address them tonight, but that she would speak to the nation at some point on Wednesday. And she will have to. I mean, at some point she has to come out and concede that she has lost and
you know, attempt to give some explanation as to why, and, you know, and address her supporters as well. Thank them for the work that they put into this campaign, albeit that it didn't succeed in any way. It will be very interesting to see what Kamala Harris says when she does that, because how can you graciously concede to somebody whom you described as unhinged, unstable, said met the definition of a fascist when he was described like that by his own former chief of staff, John Kelly? You know, she has given some very apocalyptic warnings about what will happen to America if Donald Trump is re-elected. And that is, of course, the situation that we are now facing. So it will be fascinating to see how she gets around that and how she explains to the country and principally to her supporters what went so very badly wrong here for her campaign.
Sarah, thank you very much. Lindy Lee, who is a Democratic strategist and indeed campaigned with Kamala Harris, is here in our Washington, D.C. studio. Ms. Lee, good morning to you. Thank you for spending the time
with us. Such a pleasure joining you.
Answer that question, first of all, from Sarah Smith, if you can. What do you think Kamala Harris's approach is going to be now to the presidency, the return presidency of Donald Trump, and the things that she has to do now, including certify the result?
Mm-hmm. Thank you for having me. She's certainly not going to do what Donald Trump did 4 years ago and to deny the outcome of the election. She's not going to do any of that. She's not going to launch an insurrection against the Capitol. I know with all my heart that she's going to come out in a few hours and graciously accept the outcome of the election, especially when all the votes are certified in all the battleground states. The seven battleground states are definitely ironclad. And it's just, this is not the outcome that we expected at all. We had a donor party prior to the celebration at Howard University, and everyone went in euphorically. Someone even told me that we were going to win Iowa. I looked at him skeptically, but I mean, that was a level of enthusiasm and positivity. So this is just like whiplash for us. And, you know, I already know I can give you the postmortem right now. It really came down to four factors: immigration, economy, Biden, and Tim Walz. Those are the major categories as I see it.
And when you mentioned the last of those, Tim Walz, that's her vice presidential pick. Are you saying he was the wrong pick?
He absolutely was. And I'm sorry if that offends anybody, but that's the truth. And I'm not here to gaslight your viewers. I'm here to tell the truth.
So in other words, you're saying she should have picked Josh Shapiro.
She certainly should have. And I know
Governor
Josh Shapiro
of Pennsylvania.
Exactly. I've known him for a very long time. He appointed me commissioner of Pennsylvania. So I know him I know him very well. He is remarkably popular in Pennsylvania, and he's widely perceived as a moderate, not as a leftist.
It wouldn't have been enough though, would it?
I think it would have prevented a bloodbath for sure. I think this would not have been the outcome. I think there was even a chance that maybe we would have held on to the blue wall states, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. You know why? Because the country sees them as a moderate. And that would have counterbalanced the perception of Kamala Harris as a San Francisco liberal, the radical that Trump keeps saying that she is.
Lindy Lee, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us this morning. And we have heard from Donald Trump, and it looks as if what Lindy Lee is telling us is right, that Kamala Harris is going to speak later, but not, it seems, in our time.
Not quite yet, no. But at 14 minutes to 8, someone who is going to talk is Mike, because he's here with the latest on the sport. Hi, Mike.
Hello, Emma. Thank you. Good morning. For the first time since April 2018, Manchester City have suffered a third successive defeat. The latest loss came in the Champions League last night. Pep Guardiola's side took the lead against Sporting Lisbon, but went on to lose 4-1 in Portugal.
Sometimes it happens. Try to find an explanation. Yeah, I had to try to find it, but sometimes it's just football, you know? Men accept it. It's just, okay, life is that, or the sport is that. Sometimes the good or bad moments, okay, we face them, or the reality, or we said, oh, we start to complain, we start to find excuses. Everyone has to try to be better, be better, be better, and we will find it.
Well, that's the assessment of Pep Guardiola. Commentator Conor McNamara was watching the match last night, and he joins us now. Conor, what went wrong for City?
What a terrible night for Manchester City. Their heaviest European defeat in years. Erling Haaland missing a penalty, crashing it off the crossbar. I guess that sort of summed up the kind of mood that they had throughout the evening. It is three defeats in a row now in all competitions. Manchester City's worst run of form in 6 years. And I guess the most intriguing part is that this latest misery for the reigning Premier League champions was all heaped upon them by the man who's about to become the new Manchester United manager. And Ruben Amorim looked very relaxed throughout last night. He was dressed in his grey long-sleeve T-shirt. He might need a few more layers than that by the time he reaches the banks of Salford Quays, but otherwise he is living up to the hype, and there has been considerable hype about him. But Sporting remain unbeaten in all competitions this season, and Amorim looks to be exactly what Manchester United need right now.
Yeah, certainly his stock will rise even higher now, you would think. What a send-off for him at Sporting in his final home match in charge, and as you say, quite the early marker to lay down on his new club, Manchester United's biggest rivals.
Yeah, Ruben Amorim's last home game at the Jose Alvalade Stadium last night. He's got one more away match in charge of Sporting at the weekend against Braga. But he was given the proper hero's departure at the end. The players were throwing and catching him in the air. It's a night that actually, when you look back at it, started so well for Manchester City. They were 1-0 up inside 4 minutes. Phil Foden dispatched a neat finish. But inspired by a hat-trick from Victor Gyökeres, the former Brighton, Swansea, Coventry City striker who's gone on now to become one of Europe's hottest properties, Sporting tactically got it spot on. I think that's what's going to really excite the Manchester United fans as they wait for the arrival of their new manager. And a date for all our diaries, Mike, Sunday, December 15th, Manchester City against United, the Manchester Derby, Pep Guardiola against Ruben Amorim again.
All right, thanks to Connor. Got to leave it there. Elsewhere, better news for Liverpool last night. A Luis Diaz hat-trick saw them thrashed by a Leverkusen 4-0 at Anfield. And Celtic, too, had a night to remember. They came from behind to win a Champions League match for the first time, beating RB Leipzig 3-1 at Celtic Park.
It's 11 minutes to 8. Thanks for that, Mike. It is time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning, the Reverend Canon Dr. Jennifer Smith, Superintendent Minister of Wellesley Chapel and Leeson Mission.
Good morning. And I say that having been awake most of the night. As we've watched this campaign unfold, Americans on both sides have become more genuinely afraid of each other and more afraid of what a country led by the other side will look like. Although I've lived in the UK for over 30 years, I still deeply love the United States, my flawed and beautiful homeland. I cast my vote several weeks ago in Massachusetts, but my own family across the nation are both Democrat and Republican. We are divided, as many are. I've lived with fear not just about the outcome of the election, but also about what else may happen. Though the full count is not finished, it seems clear we have a Trump victory. While both campaigns have raised the temperature, we should not pretend that they have equal share in stoking a climate of threat and menace. This has global consequences, and I hope calls for civility and peace on all sides will have impact. In fear, I may want a strong leader, someone to go toe-to-toe with other strong leaders in this dangerous world. Left and right alike may fall prey to this temptation. Scripture records just this kind of fear and its results. The elders of the people asked the prophet Samuel for a strong leader. A king like the other nations have, they said, to go before us and fight our battles. God told Samuel to give the people their leader, but also to warn them, be careful what you wish for. They got their king, to be sure, and all the consequences of which Samuel warned in the generations that followed. The new president will hopefully emphasize healing and prosperity for all. But in any event, our faith offers an antidote to fear. Anyone with an army or a political machine can be a conqueror. I will make you more than conquerors, says the Apostle Paul in the letter to the Romans. The promise and the hope is for something more durable than any one-off victory, an end to the destructive cycle of successive empires rise and fall. I readily see the attraction of calling for a nation to be great or great again, but this is to set our sights too low, as if the best a nation can hope for is to be on top a few years until a bigger, smarter, more advanced nation comes along. God's promise is for the healing of all the nations, not just the one. Today will be a new chapter in the USA. It certainly is not the end.
And that was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Canon Dr. Jennifer Smith. It brings us to 8 minutes to eight.
We are going to help our country heal. That was Donald Trump's key message as he gave his victory speech in the past half an hour. That is his agenda for America. He's also talked of fighting for each and every citizen. But what does it mean for the rest of the world at a time when we see wars, particularly in the Middle East and Ukraine, areas where the US position is particularly critical, as well as international challenges in economics, the climate and the changing face of technology? Well, the Labour MP, Emily Thornberry, joining us now, Chair of Parliament, the Parliament's Foreign Affairs Select Committee, of course, former Shadow Foreign Secretary, and Sir Nigel Sheinwald, former UK ambassador to the US. Emily, to start with you, your reaction to what we expect to be the new president?
Well, I think it's disappointing. I think that across most of the West, it was hoped that the result would be Kamala Harris, not least because it would be predictable. I think we wake up this morning in an unpredictable world with a president who we don't really know what their policy, what his policy on things are going to be. And we know what he says. He sometimes says contradictory things. And so it'll be quite challenging to know how to approach him and what it is that he's going to do on the major, you know, major theatres at the moment.
Well, those unknowns, although, you know, he has been president before, of course, yeah. And I was just looking back at you.
Oh, I'll do my best to help.
When there was a state trip for him here, state visit here, you described him as a racist sexual predator at the time.
Yes, well, he is. But he is the president of the United States, and we need to work with him. And what we need to do, I think, is make sure that we look after our interests, which means that we need to work multilaterally with our friends and allies. We need to identify, in relation to the United States, what it is that they want to do. But I think we also need to stick close to those whose values are similar to ours. Most Americans, I think, do have similar values to ours, but there may well be times when we won't agree with Donald Trump and we need to stick with our friends.
Let me bring in Sir Nigel Sheinwald. Good morning.
Morning.
Attention will be turning to some of those key conflicts, not least Ukraine. As we expect, if it's as we expect, President Trump again, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, that is the live case study. I mean, we had 4 years of the presidency. We've had a lot of statements from him since. I think the rest of the world is entitled to feel a great deal of apprehension. Not everywhere in the world, you know, in Israel, in Russia, in North Korea, one or two other places, there'll no doubt be hats being thrown in the air. But most of America's allies in the world will be feeling extremely apprehensive. And Ukraine and NATO are going to be the areas he has to look at, because that is where there are urgent decisions needed. And this is where the United Kingdom needs to play its hand above all else, yes, there and on the Middle East in the days and weeks ahead. And I agree with Emily Thornberry. I mean, this is a presidency that most Western governments, Western European governments, wouldn't have wanted, but you just have to deal with it as best you can. I would say maintaining a bit of distance. There's no point trying to cozy up to a Trump presidency any more than there was in 2017, 2020, working with others where we can, strengthening our position in Europe. That's one of the Labour government's plans anyway, that is reinforced in its salience by the election of Trump. I think the truth is that even if Kamala Harris had been made president, we were at the end of an Atlanticist streak in the United States. She would have been a more conventional and probably more supportive president, but she was largely an unknown quantity. And she wouldn't have had Joe Biden's sympathy for Europe and understanding and experience of Europe. So we're coming to the end of that sort of era. We must stand up for our own interests, work with others, work with the United States where we can, and try to trim back some of his worst instincts, which would be against our interests in the Middle East, in Europe, in relation to the Global South and so on.
Emily, to some of those points there and what you were saying around our relationship and how to work alongside Donald Trump, are you concerned about that potential relationship? Not least, it wasn't the biggest story in America, but it was a big point here when his campaign has expressed concern and officially complained, taking potential legal action about Labour staffers going over there to volunteer for Kamala Harris's campaign.
So I think the first thing I'd say is that I agree with Nigel Sheinwald that we shouldn't be holding Donald Trump's hand. I think that we need to be clear about what it is that we stand for. And I think also we need to be confident in ourselves, because we are in a pretty unique position in terms of the G7. We have Britain has a government with a large majority, a progressive government. We're going to be here for 5 years, and we can be a force for good. And I think that we need to make sure that we hold our heads up and we work with friends and allies with whom we have common interests. And when we have common interests with Donald Trump, then we work with him. But we need to be clear that, I mean, one of the other things I would put onto the list is obviously great concern about his attitude to climate change. If you remember, he went back on the Paris Agreement and has said that he won't agree to any other climate change agreement. So we need to stick with our allies in relation to that and make it clear what it is that that Western allies think about this.
Emily Thornberry, Sir Nigel Sharman, thank you.
3 minutes to eight. Let's turn to Michael Burke, who has a new moral dilemma.
Morning, Justin. Morning, Emma. The tax increases on private schools, though long-trailed, were among the most emotive measures in last week's blockbuster budget, because they're widely seen to be as much a moral issue as a question of politics or economics. It was a former Conservative Education Secretary, Michael Gove, who asked, why should the state support the already wealthy by advantage for their children? Others see it as an attack on aspiration and excellence, a vindictive piece of class warfare on parents who scrimp and save to pay fees, according to Mr. Gove's former colleague David Davis. Taxing private schools, justice or spite? The moral maze after the news at 8 tonight.
Thanks very much for that, Michael. Looking forward to it. 2 minutes to eight. Let's get the latest on the weather. Simon King's here again.
Hi, Emma. Yeah, we've got lots of fine, settled weather across the UK. Once again this morning, it's rather misty and a little bit murky out there, but it is mild for most of us. The exception is the northeast of Scotland. But let's have a look at the forecast today for all of southern England, Wales, the Midlands and eastern England, where the mist and fog is clearing. Visibilities are improving, but it's going to stay pretty cloudy and overcast all day. There's going to be some light winds, so it's going to feel calm and actually still relatively mild. Temperatures 13 to 15 degrees for many, but we could see the odd 16 or 17 degrees to the north of high ground in Devon and Wales. Across northern England and Northern Ireland, again, mist, fog, some low cloud, which will tend to lift up and it'll stay quite cloudy for much of the day, but perhaps some breaks in that cloud towards the northeast of England. Temperatures 13 to 15 degrees, but locally in Northern Ireland, 16 or 17 Celsius. Now, across Scotland today, some clear skies in the northeast of Scotland, where it's been quite chilly this morning. That's where we're going to have some sunshine. Elsewhere, it's pretty cloudy. We've got some rain affecting the far northwest of Scotland today. Otherwise, though, dry and temperatures are 13 to 16.
Thank you, Simon. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett in London, Justin Webb in Washington, D.C. It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 6th of November. The headlines this morning. Donald Trump says he has an unprecedented and powerful mandate after projections put him on the verge of winning another U.S. presidential term. He's taken three crucial swing states, including Pennsylvania, and in the last half hour gave a jubilant victory speech.
It's a political victory that our country has never seen before, nothing like this. I want to thank the American people for the extraordinary honor of being elected your 47th president and your 45th president.
There is despondency among supporters of Kamala Harris, who were told she wouldn't be speaking until later today. I've been talking to both Republicans and Democrats. We'll be hearing from them after the news.
We'll also be taking the long view on this result, what it will mean, turning to the historian Neil Ferguson and the editor of The Economist magazine, Zani Minton-Beddoes. And as Kemi Badenoch, coming to UK politics, prepares for her first appearance at Prime Minister's Questions as Leader of the Opposition, we'll discuss the challenges for the new Tory leader. All that and more to come. But first, the BBC News is read by Vijay Alice.
Donald Trump is on the cusp of an extraordinary return to the White House after he was projected as the winner of three of the crucial swing states in the presidential election. Our U.S. partner, CBS, has projected that Mr. Trump will win the southern states of Georgia and North Carolina and the northern state of Pennsylvania. Although he is still a few electoral college votes short of confirming his win, Mr. Trump appeared on stage in Florida to declare that he had made history. Our North America editor, Sarah Smith, has just sent this report from Washington.
After a long, tense and acrimonious campaign, Donald Trump has all but won this race. Before midnight, the first of the key battleground states, North Carolina, was projected to be won by the former president, Then the state of Georgia too was added to his column of expected victories, and the direction of the night became apparent. The news that the biggest and most important swing state of Pennsylvania was also projected to go his way was the final step. And Donald Trump appeared in front of his cheering supporters to celebrate what he called a magnificent victory for the American people.
We're going to fix our borders. We're going to fix everything about our country. And we made history for a reason tonight, and the reason is going to be just that. We overcame obstacles that nobody thought possible, and it is now clear that we've achieved the most incredible political thing. Look what happened. Is this crazy?
At the Kamala Harris HQ event in Washington, there was dejection. Her campaign chair, Cedric Richmond, came out to tell her supporters their candidate was not coming to speak to them, a clear sign they thought she was on course to lose.
We still have votes to count. We still have states that have not been called yet. We will continue overnight to fight to make sure that every vote is counted, that every voice has spoken. So you won't hear from the vice president tonight, but you will hear from her tomorrow.
This is the most dramatic comeback in American political history. A man who, when he was ejected from the White House 4 years ago, refused to accept the result and watched his supporters violently attack the Capitol in an attempt to keep him in power. Who has since been indicted in 4 criminal cases and convicted in one of them. And has yet now won re-election by what looks like it may be a bigger margin than his original victory in 2016.
A Republican congressman, Jake LaTourneur, told this program that Mr. Trump reached new voters by following an unconventional media strategy, prioritizing podcasts over mainstream media interviews.
They decided we are going to meet people where they are. We're going to be innovative. We're going to be creative. And it's a weird thing. I'm a young guy, but I've been in politics a long time. And so when I see a new media strategy like this, I instantly get nervous because I think, for goodness sakes, what are you doing on a podcast? But the truth of the matter is the person that holds Walter Cronkite's seat, the CBS Evening News, is getting far fewer viewers than does Joe Rogan.
The mood at Kamala Harris's headquarters in Washington, D.C. changed markedly when the results went against her. Our correspondent Michelle Fleury is there.
Supporters came to Howard University expecting a party. Instead, after all the nervousness, anxiety and trepidation, there was a growing sense of disappointment as swing states like North Carolina and Georgia tipped in Donald Trump's favour. Hitting first-time voter and first-year student Hayden Johnson particularly hard, since he's from Atlanta, Georgia.
I just really feel like, you know, this should be the turning step, it should be the turning point, but I think our country is regressing, so.
The crowds evaporated almost immediately after it became clear Kamala Harris wouldn't be speaking tonight at the historic black college she once attended.
The Republicans are projected to have gained Senate seats in Ohio and West Virginia, which would give them control of the chamber in the House of Representatives, where the Republicans are on course to retain their majority. All 435 seats are up for grabs. Our North America correspondent Peter Bowes has the details.
The balance of power in Congress can make or break a new president's aspirations to bring about change in America. With votes still being counted, the Republicans are projected to win the Senate after gaining 2 seats. The Texan Ted Cruz, a close ally of Donald Trump, held his seat after a strong campaign by a Democratic challenger. The Republicans have also picked up a seat in the House, but it's too early to call the final result. In Delaware, voters made history electing Sarah McBride, a Democrat, as the first openly transgender member of Congress. In a notable governor's race, the Democratic candidate in North Carolina defeated a Republican who's been mired in controversy over comments he's alleged to have made on a pornographic website.
10 U.S. states have also held ballots on abortion rights. Voters in Florida fell just short of enshrining fuller abortion rights in the state constitution. In Arizona, voters passed a constitutional amendment which extends the length of time a woman can get an abortion, with projections suggesting Missouri will do the same. The initiatives were in response to the Supreme Court's decision in 2022 to overturn a long-standing judgment which gave women the constitutional right to abortion. The FBI says its name and logo have been used in several false messages about the election. The agency also said hoax bomb threats were directed at polling stations in swing states, including Georgia, Michigan and Wisconsin. It said the threats appear to come from Russia. The Russian embassy in Washington called the allegations malicious slander. Our political editor, Chris Mason, now assesses how the expected result will be met at Downing Street.
This, to put it gently, is the more complicated scenario for the UK government, and complicated above all for one obvious reason, Mr. Trump's wild unpredictability. The government has sought to prepare, but the prep may only count for so much. How will Sir Keir Starmer, the North London human rights lawyer, gel with the brash New York billionaire? They met in New York in September. The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, has met his running mate, J.D. Vance, too. Those close to the Foreign Secretary say he's been putting in the legwork for months to get to know and to understand Donald Trump and those around him. Mr. Lammy's described J.D. Vance as my friend and Donald Trump as often misunderstood. Quite the outreach towards the man he once called a tyrant in a toupee. Privately, there is a recognition in Whitehall things aren't likely to be smooth, more likely to be bumpy, noisy.
In other news, thousands of Israelis have taken to the streets to protest against the dismissal of the Defence Minister, Yoav Gallant. Police in Tel Aviv used water cannon and horses to disperse them. Mr. Gallant was sacked by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu last night because of what he called a crisis of trust. Our correspondent Joe Inwood reports from Jerusalem.
Yoav Gallant and Benjamin Netanyahu have long had a difficult relationship. It is now broken. The now former defence minister said his desire to compromise and get a hostage deal, to make ultra-Orthodox Jews serve in the military, and the need for an inquiry into the October the 7th attacks were behind his dismissal. The prime minister said trust had cracked between the pair. Water cannon and horses were used to disperse protesters who took to the street overnight. Yoav Gallant will be replaced by Israel Katz, thought to be even more hawkish on the current conflict.
Government officials say a case of bird flu has been confirmed at a site near Hornsey in East Yorkshire. Some restrictions have been put in place and poultry at the infected premises is being culled. Here's Will Vernon.
Avian flu is an infectious virus that spreads among birds, and in rare cases, it can be passed on to humans. The UK saw dozens of outbreaks on poultry farms last year, but no one became ill. Earlier this year, Britain declared itself bird flu free. Now, officials say there's been a new outbreak and all poultry at the site will be humanely culled. Two control zones will be put in place, although the restrictions only apply to those who keep poultry, such as farmers. The latest government advice on bird flu says the risk to the public remains very low.
There's a warning that 40% of households in England and Wales may struggle to afford higher water bills from April. The estimate is based on a survey of 9,500 people from the Consumer Council for Water. The regulator Ofwat has proposed allowing water companies to increase bills by 21% above inflation over the next 5 years to raise money to tackle leaks and sewage pollution.
Vijay, thank you. 8:10 is the time. Not since the 19th century has a president left office, then returned 4 years later and successfully fought his way back to the Oval Office. It is a staggering victory that Donald Trump has managed to achieve. Just before 7:30 this morning, he declared victory after Fox News became the first of the US networks to project that he would beat Kamala Harris and become the 47th president of the United States.
Every single day I will be fighting for you, and with every breath in my body, I will not rest until we have delivered the strong, safe, and prosperous America that our children deserve and that you deserve. This will truly be the golden age of America. That's what we have to have. This is a magnificent victory for the American people that will allow us to make America great again.
The co-chair of Kamala Harris's campaign, Cedric Richmond, told the vice president's supporters that she would address the nation later on Wednesday.
We still have states that have not been called yet. We will continue overnight to fight to make sure that every vote is counted.
that every voice has spoken. So you won't hear from the vice president tonight, but you will hear from her tomorrow. She will be back here tomorrow to address not only the HU family, not only to address her supporters, but to address the nation.
One of the things Kamala Harris seems to have failed to do is attract Latino voters in large enough numbers to make a difference. The Latino vote is important. In all of the swing states, it's bigger than the difference between the presidential candidates last time. Mike Madrid is a Republican strategist and former political director for the California Republican Party. He told me why Donald Trump appeared to have done so well among that group of voters.
This is an economic voter that's been hit very hard by the economy, not just during COVID, which was true, but in the recovery where everybody else seemed to do quite well. The working class, the lower class, is affordability is a major significant problem. And Latinos disproportionately have been impacted by it. And it's not a good situation. Only 20% of Latinos think the economy is in good or excellent condition.
Let us turn first to Nigel Farage, the MP for Clacton, of course, leader of the Reform UK, campaigner for Donald Trump. And he was there at the rally an hour or so ago when Donald Trump spoke. Mr. Farage, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Were you surprised?
No, absolutely not. I really wasn't. I've been feeling very bullish about the thing all day. I was at some polling stations this morning in Pennsylvania around about 7 o'clock, talking to voters as they were streaming in. And one or two very interesting observations, the first of which was, well, there were more Trump signs on people's lawns than there were in 2020 or 2016. Kind of, he wasn't the bogeyman in quite the way he'd been seen to be. Plus, I think what he put together here was a remarkable coalition. This wasn't just Donald Trump at the top. Yes, of course, he was the head, but he had on his right-hand side Elon Musk, on his left-hand side a member of the Kennedy family, something that would have been unthinkable at any point in the last 70 years. That was the first thing that he did. The second thing with the voters that he did was put together another coalition, a coalition of lots of Hispanic voters, many more black voters than any Republican candidate has ever managed to achieve, more Jewish voters than they've ever achieved, and more young voters than they've ever achieved. And what is very interesting about the Trump movement is its critics call it all sorts of nasty names. The truth is, in many ways, it's bringing Americans together. And I could see that over the course of the last few months.
How do you think he'll govern now? You know him, you talk to him. There have been all sorts of fears expressed long and hard, not just by Democrats, actually, but by others as well, about what he will do, about putting his opponents in prison, about rounding up people and sending them out of the country, breaking up families, etc. What sort of a president has he told you that he'll be?
Well, first things first, he's not a vindictive man. He really isn't. He's actually quite good at forgiving. Is he going to want to pursue his opponents through the courts in the same way that he's been pursued so relentlessly and in many cases without basis? No, he's going to be too busy to do that. So no, he won't do that. He won't do that. He's far too bright to do that. The second question that you ask, of course, is the classic liberal mainstream media question that seems to assume that anybody who's illegally come into a country should be allowed to stay. No, I'm quite sure there'll be people who've come illegally that will be asked to leave. I've no doubt about that. And of course, there's a lesson for us in that. I mean, you know, if people that crossed the channel were deported, then more wouldn't come. But the most important answer to your question is this. How will he govern? He's going to be a genuine radical. What you are going to see from this Trump administration, and I'm guessing that Elon Musk will be the man that is tasked to do it, is there will be a big fight back against the administrative bureaucratic state, which is far too big, far too powerful, and actually very undemocratic. And that's the really, I think, exciting thing that we're going to see.
Nigel Farage, thank you very much. Let us turn to Mike Murphy, who is a Republican strategist, but someone who has been a very firm opponent of Donald Trump for some time now. Mike Murphy, good morning to you. Thank you for talking to us.
Oh, absolutely. Good morning.
Just to take that last point from Nigel Farage first, it is really striking, isn't it, that some of the things that Donald Trump has said about immigration have struck a chord with white Americans, but actually, really interestingly, with Latinos who have supported him when he has said we need to deport people who are in this country illegally. What does that tell you?
Well, he has overperformed kind of the normal Republican number, particularly with younger male Latinos. But I think we have to be careful. Our politics are a little different than the UK. Our party platforms are not quite as important. In this campaign, the biggest number in the polling was about two-thirds of Americans who said the country was badly off on the wrong track. And anger about immigration was part of that. But the biggest thing was anger about inflation and the cost of goods. And so that tidal wave grabbed Donald Trump and pushed him into office. That's what our exit polling seems to indicate, because they wanted to fire the Biden administration.
Oh, are you still there, Mike Murphy?
I'm there. I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes. No, sorry. Carry on, Hello? Mike. We lost you for a moment, but you're back.
No, I apologize. So it was a big economic protest vote that kind of lifted up Donald Trump and put him in. It was less a referendum on him, though anger about immigration was definitely part of the equation that Trump was able to exploit to win.
What sort of a president do you think he's going to be now?
I don't think he'll change much, which is troubling to many of us, particularly people who care about the Atlantic Alliance and NATO. There's a big question remaining. Our system, as you know, is, you know, different organs have power. The Republicans are going to get a bigger majority than it looks like right now in the Senate. Trump's going to be the president. The question is the lower house, which is too close to call, waiting on a bunch of California races. It could go either way. Very, very important for the Democrats to hold on to that majority control so there's some checks and balances. But they may lose it. Trump may get all three, House, Senate, and the presidency, and that would give him tremendous power. So that drama will continue for the next day or two while the last votes are counted.
And not only all three, but also potentially a majority of the popular vote, which I don't think many people saw coming.
No, I think that's part of the surprise. A lot of us in the political business thought, well, in a normal election, she would lose because of the economic rejection of Biden. But Trump had so much baggage, he's in the way what should be an easy Republican win. What happened was people held their nose and hit the red ejector button to get rid of the Biden administration. They were willing to pay the price of Trump because they thought things would be better economically. The pain of inflation and the damage it does to incumbent politicians cannot be underestimated. And I think there was some underestimating of that before today.
Mike Murphy, thank you very much for talking to us. Let us turn to Jim Costa, Democratic Congressman, Representative for California's 21st Congressional District. Mr. Costa, good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you doing in London?
Yeah, good. Thank you. What for you went wrong?
Well, I'm winning by a good margin, so I think you're reflecting upon what's happened nationwide. And I think the House is still too early to call. It will probably take a day or two, and the Democrats could still turn the House and achieve the majority. We'll see. We won't know for a good day or two, I would suspect.
And just on that, if I could drill down on that for a moment, Congressman, it really, Mike Murphy was just telling us, that really matters. Because if it is a clean sweep, the presidency, the Senate and the House, he can do an awful lot more, can't he? He is much more powerful than if he doesn't have the House. How important is it now that the Democrats win the House, in your view?
Well, it's very important because we have a system of checks and balances in our system of government. And Congress has, in the past, had circumstances in which we've had one party or the other in control of one or either house and the administration of a different party. But the House of Representatives controls the budget, the purse strings, as we say. And clearly, if in fact the former president is successful. And by the way, Associated Press has still not called it. They've not called Wisconsin, Michigan, Nevada, or Arizona. And while currently the wind is at the former President Trump's back at this point in time, until those states are determined, we won't know the final outcome. However, the Senate will be in the hands of the Republicans, and the House is still not to be determined, and that's big. The Speaker of the House is a Democrat, and we have a majority. Who knows how many members? I mean, the current majority of the House is 4 Republicans. So in California, we have 6 seats that are up for grabs, and 5 of them are occupied by Republicans. And in those 5 seats, the Democrats are ahead in 3 of them.
So you've still got a chance.
Oh, yes.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Costa. What Mike Murphy was telling us, that fundamentally the reason why Kamala Harris didn't win is that she was running as an incumbent. She didn't manage not to do that, and the economy damaged her hugely. Is that going to be the take of the wider party, of the Democratic Party as well?
Well, I think there's a lot of, as we say, using football terms, a different kind of football in the U.S., a Monday morning quarterbacking, and of course Wednesday and the rest of this week, when we determine what the final outcome is in the presidential race, will be a number of factors. But I think, frankly, the vice president, Kamala Harris, ran for 107 days, a remarkable campaign. The economy obviously had an impact. Inflation had an impact. Cost of living had an impact. But yet, the American economy is the strongest economy in the world. We've had a soft landing. And you look at the economists on the Wall Street Journal indicating with inflation down, with gas prices down, with interest rates down, and yet the stock market at an all-time high. There's always a transition between when an economy rebounds and when the people feel the impact of that positive rebound. And clearly, in this case, many Americans felt that they had not yet begun to feel the benefits of this economy that was rebounding. That did not help
Jim Costa,
Vice President.
Democratic Congressman from California, thank you very much for talking to us this morning.
Justin, it's 24 minutes past 8. I'll come back to you in a moment to get a sense from you about what a day this is potentially with this election. But coming to the UK's political response, the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, has issued a statement congratulating President-elect Trump. He says on his historic election victory, he goes on to say, "I look forward to working with you in the years ahead." I'm joined now by our political editor, Chris Mason. Chris, good morning. It's an interesting statement. It's obviously one you would expect at this point in many ways, but it comes not long, only days after the Trump campaign filed a legal complaint against Labour officials accusing those who went to volunteer for Kamala Harris's campaign of foreign interference. Do we just forget all of that now?
No, I suspect we don't. And I suspect, Emma, it was a kind of a amuse-bouche for the diplomacy to come over the next 4 years. Because if we learned anything during the first Trump administration, is that his trademark is to do diplomacy in an unconventional way. We got a little blast of that with their anger, their frustration, perhaps some theatrical in the campaign, other parts of it authentic around that injudiciously worded social media post from a Labour staffer encouraging people to go and campaign for Kamala Harris. As you say, in the last couple of minutes, a formal public statement from Keir Starmer congratulating President-elect Trump, as he says, on your historic election victory. I look forward to working with you in the years ahead. There's a couple of further paragraphs that I think would have featured if the result had been the equal and opposite, about the closest of allies standing shoulder to shoulder. The reality, Emma, is that this is the more complicated outcome diplomatically for the UK. The government here has been trying to put in the work to build bridges with the with Team Trump. They met the Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary Donald Trump in New York at the end of September. But there's a widespread expectation that it will be difficult, it'll be unconventional, it'll be noisy, and it'll be turbulent. And London, like so many European capitals and other capitals this morning, waking up to that reality for the next 4 years.
Well, the former US ambassador Woody Johnson, again at the only at the end of the summer, was at pains to say that the US will remember, Trump will remember that David Lammy, our now foreign secretary, called him a racist as well. There's been a lot of personal remarks made, and we were just hearing from the former shadow foreign secretary Emily Thornberry here, who's also standing by her comments that he's a racist and he's sexist. But putting, as I suppose in some ways, what people have personally thought, but now they're in offices of state, how they will work together. You say it's a more complicated outcome, and many thoughts this morning and questions over what Trump's, as a president again, approach will be to Ukraine.
Exactly that. So precisely that. So speaking to people in the Foreign Office and elsewhere in the last couple of weeks, that they've been at pains to say, look, America, irrespective of outcome, is fundamentally in a different place on Ukraine, frankly cares less about Ukraine than Europe. However, there was an expectation that a Harris administration would be more willing to listen and frankly perhaps would be more willing to accept that there should be a long-term commitment to the support of Ukraine. Now, there's been an attempt in the conversations that have happened prior to today to make that argument to Donald Trump, but we've heard the language he's used, haven't we, about his belief that he could, his rhetoric around being able to sort out the conflict in a day, the fear from some that to do that would effectively amount to a Russian victory. So yeah, there is a huge amount of work to be done diplomatically around that question of Ukraine. Downing Street, I think, will be seeking to speak to President-elect Trump pretty shortly, to be one of the first Western leaders to do that, and then attempting to schedule a visit to Washington in the early months of next year, because they are so conscious, both with Ukraine and the Middle East, that every week counts, and a moment like this is bound to raise serious questions about both of those conflicts and the US's outlook on the two of them.
Chris Mason, thank you. As we're talking, there's various leader statements coming in congratulating Donald Trump, not least from President Zelensky of Ukraine, saying congratulations on his impressive election victory. I recall our great meeting with President Trump back in September, where we discussed in detail the Ukraine-US strategic partnership, the victory plan, and ways to put an end to Russian aggression against Ukraine. And also just in from the French president, from Macron, I've just spoken with the German Chancellor. He says, Olaf Scholz, we will work towards a more united, stronger, more sovereign Europe in this new context by cooperating with the United States of America and defending our interests and values. Justin, just to come back to you, of course, you're here with us, as always, on the Today programme, but you host Americast, co-host that. You've been following this extremely closely, and also with your history as the North America editor here at the BBC. Put this in a bit of context for us, what today means, what it looks like, this election.
Well, it looks like an election that the Democrats feared might happen, but hoped wouldn't, in this sense. They thought they had managed to persuade the nation that Kamala Harris was in some way not associated closely with the current administration. The current administration, I think we often forget this, the current administration of Joe Biden is hugely, hugely unpopular. Mm. He is personally hugely unpopular, whether he deserves that or not. And whatever they think about the economy, and we've just been hearing from a Democratic Party congressman that the US economy is in fine fettle, there has been this huge bout of inflation, and Americans are angry about it, and they want someone to blame, and they have blamed the administration, and Kamala Harris is the vice president of that administration. And in the end, they could not escape from those facts.
Well, it is quite a moment. We're following it as it unfolds, and stay here with us for that. But at 29 minutes to nine, Mike is back with the sport.
Emma, thank you. There were a couple of emphatic victories last night for British clubs in the Champions League.
Remember, remember the 5th of November at Celtic Park, because Celtic, for the very first time in the Champions League, came from a goal down to turn this one around against the German giants of RB Leipzig.
And Luis Diaz with his first hat-trick for Liverpool. That finishes the night. Diaz, the hat-trick hero. Liverpool 4 wins.
Yes, it is. 4 wins out of 4 for Liverpool in the Champions League this season. They currently sit top of the league table after a 4-0 victory over Bayer Leverkusen last night. The Colombian forward Luis Diaz with a hat-trick at Anfield. Meanwhile, it was a famous night for Celtic too. They came from behind to beat RB Leipzig 3-1 in Glasgow. It's a second win of the campaign for Brendan Rodgers' side, who have now given themselves a real chance of making the knockout stages.
Listen, we just want to be a competitive team at this level. There's been obviously a lot of criticism around the club at this level, but we want to be really competitive, make it really difficult for teams. And we can't look any further than that. It's a great performance. It was a great night for the football club, and we'll take that energy into our next games.
Contrasting fortunes for Manchester City, though. They've suffered a third successive defeat for the first time since April 2018 after defeats in the Premier League and League Cup to Bournemouth and Tottenham, respectively, recently. Pep Guardiola's team were last night beaten 4-1 away to Sporting Lisbon.
We played really bad against Bournemouth. We played really good today. Emotion is difficult when we play the first half that we played, and after 2 minutes, second half, we are losing 3-1. It's not easy to swallow, but it's an experience, and I don't give up. Maybe people waiting, but I'm not give up. No, that's for sure.
Well, the win for Sporting Lisbon gave their manager, Ruben Amorim, victory in his final home match in charge before he takes over at Manchester United. Elsewhere, back-to-back home defeats for Real Madrid in the Champions League. The holders were beaten 3-1 by AC Milan at the Bernabeu. And one other bit of football news, the BBC has retained Premier League radio commentary rights for another 4 seasons. It means 5Live and BBC Sounds will broadcast 209 matches per season up until the 2029 campaign. Finally, cricket. England captain Ben Stokes has chosen to skip next year's Indian Premier League, but the former England bowler James Anderson has registered for the upcoming auction. England's leading wicket taker, who has retired from international cricket as of this summer, aged 42, has put his name forward alongside fellow pace bowler Jofra Archer. And Jimmy Anderson will be a guest in this programme tomorrow in the studio.
Mike, thanks very much for that. Let's hear what's coming up. Hello. Today we hear from a civil engineer, capable, dependable, operating in sites all over the world, a man for whom risk and uncertainty were part of the job. And then, one day, during a project in North Africa, things took a horrifying and dramatic turn, plunging him into an international crisis which had personal, traumatic consequences. Life-changing. On BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. After the news. At 9.
I absolutely love life-changing, of course. That's Dr. Sian Williams with what's coming up. Let me tell you what's happening in the weather. Dry with bright spells in northern England, northern Wales and northern Scotland. Cloudy elsewhere.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett in London. Justin Webb in Washington, D.C. It's just coming up to 25 to 9. Let's have the news from Bridgie Ellis.
Donald Trump has promised a golden age for America after projections showed he had all but won another term as president. He has secured the swing states of Georgia, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania and currently has 266 votes in the Electoral College. That's just 4 below the threshold for victory. Addressing his supporters in Florida, Mr. Trump boasted of an unprecedented and powerful mandate, and he promised to fix everything and to seal the borders. Projections also show the Republicans have secured a majority in the U.S. Senate. A Democratic strategist, Lindy Lee, told us Mr. Trump's rival, Kamala Harris, would come out in a few hours and graciously accept the outcome of the election. The Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, sent his congratulations to Donald Trump, adding that he looked forward to working with him in the years ahead. He said the U.S.-UK relationship would continue to prosper. The Ukrainian President, Volodymyr Zelensky, has also congratulated Mr. Trump on what he called an impressive victory, saying he hoped it would bring a just peace in Ukraine closer. President Macron of France and the Italian Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, also sent their congratulations. The leader of Reform UK, Nigel Farage, told us Mr. Trump would govern as a genuine radical and there would be a big fight back against what he called a bureaucratic state that is very powerful and undemocratic.
Indeed, thank you. It's 24 minutes to nine. Let's turn our attention to UK politics for just a moment, where Kemi Badenoch, the new Conservative leader, will face Sir Keir Starmer for the first time as leader of the opposition at Prime Minister's Questions. After her win, it was written in the Telegraph, Conservative Party members have chosen Mrs. Badenoch because they believe she has the charisma and force of character to take on Nigel Farage, someone we heard from just a moment ago who was at Trump's rally, or victory speech, I should say, not to mention the likelihood that she will savage Sir Keir Starmer at the dispatch box. Well, What does Kwasi Kwarteng, who was Chancellor during the short-lived premiership of Liz Truss, think of that? And Dominic Grieve, former Conservative Attorney General, who you may remember had the Conservative whip removed after a Brexit vote. Good morning to you both. Kwasi, I'll come to you. What are you expecting from Kemi Badenoch today?
Look, I think she'll be very fiery, potentially. I think she'll be very direct, forceful, and she's a very capable politician. I think she has a dynamism that is quite unusual, but she'll also be consensual as well. So I think there's fairly high expectations that she'll do quite well.
Dominic Grieve, good morning. What do you think?
I certainly think she's going to perform well at the dispatch box. There's every sign that she is feisty, she's quite combative, and she has a very straightforward style. So I think that she will be quite a challenge for Keir Starmer at the dispatch box. But of course, the role of being leader of the party has to go beyond that. She has to bring the party together. And it is pretty clear that it is divided. She has got to craft a policy and take it in a direction which everybody can support. And in view of the events of the last 5 years, that is going to be her biggest challenge. And doing that in a way which doesn't shed support, particularly in the centre ground of British politics. But also, I do accept she has a challenge from reform on the right. And how she reconciles those will be the measure of whether she's successful or not.
And on that point, coming back to you, Kwasi Kwarteng, what I mentioned from the Telegraph around, it's striking that that particular view was first about her taking on Nigel Farage and how important that is. Is that really what's in mind when you're thinking about how the Conservatives can win again?
I think Dominic's right. I think she's got to do both. I mean, it's a sort of two-dimensional problem in a way. She has to win back many of the reform voters, most of whom, all polling suggests, voted Conservative in 2019. But having done that, and I think she'd probably do that first, let's see. Having done that, she has to appeal to voters in the centre, which Dominic said was necessary as well. And I agree with him on that.
But in terms of, and then bringing the party together around what it is, what it stands for, I mean, do you feel welcome back, Dominic? Is it a place for you again?
Not at the moment, no, I don't think so. I don't wish the party ill, but they chucked me out. I'm quite happy as an independent, and I don't have political ambition to be in the House of Commons. In those circumstances, I prefer to be a spectator on the sidelines.
No,
albeit, I think, quite a benevolent one.
But I was going to say, but it's quite a good test, perhaps, to see if she can bring somebody like yourself, who considers yourself, I imagine, a Conservative, back into the fold.
Well, I am undoubtedly Conservative philosophically, but I am I'm from the liberal centre-right. There's absolutely no doubt about it. And this is a group who have progressively lost complete confidence in the Conservative Party. And that was obvious at the last election because of the hemorrhage of votes in large numbers of seats in London and the South East particularly, but actually the South West, all over the country. And on top of that, people simply sitting at home and not going to vote. So the idea that one can get back into government or as a Conservative by out-reforming reform, that I think is a fantasy.
Kwasi, as we're talking on the morning of Trump declaring victory, and it's striking, a lot of people, again, will be waking up to that news thinking perhaps there was going to be the first female leader of the United States. It's interesting to think about how Kemi Badenoch, having achieved what she's achieved, certainly as leader of the opposition, how she will work with the Trump side of things.
I think she'll work quite well and closely with them. Historically, the Conservative Party has tended, not in every instance, but tended to be probably more Republican-facing. And I know there are lots of Conservatives who prefer the Democrats. But on the whole, the Republicans are seen as a kind of sister party. I think a lot of her positions will chime with the Trump administration's positions. She's particularly fastidious about not making her identity or her ethnic origin a particularly central part of her message. She's fought against identity politics. And I think her stance on things like transgender issues, woke culture wars, if I can put it that way, her position on those things is actually probably the single thing that's propelled her to the leadership of the party. So I think she'll be very comfortable talking to the Trump administration on that.
Well, Prime Minister's questions later on this afternoon, and more to come. Kwasi Kwarteng, Dominic Grieve, thank you.
19 minutes to nine is the time. Welcome back to Washington, D.C., where Donald Trump is almost certain to be the 47th president of the United States. Most of the states are projections at the moment, or at least the swing states, but there doesn't seem to be any doubt that he is going to receive eventually the Electoral College votes that will take him over the top, as it were. Let us talk first to Will Grant, who is outside his headquarters in Miami, where there were such raucous celebrations earlier in the morning, Will, and Donald Trump himself speaking to supporters. Their mood, well, I think I can hear behind you, they're clearing it up now, but their mood at the time was not only raucous, not only joyous, but also, I sense, slightly surprised at the ease of the victory.
Yeah, I think that's very true, Justin. I think there was jubilation all the way through. I went to see Donald Trump cast his own ballot, and there was this sort of quiet confidence throughout the day, this sort of cautious optimism. Of course, all the polls suggested it would be very close, but they were fundamentally sure that their man had this and that the only way they would lose would be the result of voter fraud. Come the day, the moment that he addressed the crowd, and by that stage, Fox had given him Pennsylvania, and it was very clear that he was on course to victory. There was real jubilation in terms of the supporters inside the convention center in Palm Beach and outside where I am, who are joyous. They really feel that they've pulled off something historic here.
Will, thank you. Let us turn to Anthony Zurch, our North America correspondent, who has been monitoring events through the night and is here in our Washington, D.C. studio. When it comes to the swing states, Anthony, I mean, they are swing states, but they all seem to have swung together. Is that fair?
They all have swung together so far, and none of them have to swing to Donald Trump for Donald Trump to win the presidency. All he has to do at this point is win Alaska, which is not a swing state. So we are on the precipice, the cusp of a Donald Trump victory. But in close elections, you do tend to see things break one way or the other. They don't necessarily come down like a set of matchsticks all in different directions. And I think that is what we have seen today, that not just in the swing states, but across the map of the United States, Donald Trump surpassing his margins in 2020 and recreating an America that looks much more like that 2016 election.
President Zelensky of Ukraine has just said he hopes that a Trump victory will bring a just peace in Ukraine closer. What can we say about what Donald Trump might now do and the moves that he might make, even actually before he becomes president in January? It's something we've talked about on Americast often, because he said all sorts of things. Is it at all clear, even who his Secretary of State is going to be, et cetera, et cetera?
That's not clear. I've seen some names floated, people like Marco Rubio being a Secretary of State, but we don't know yet. I think there are going to be many more suitors for Secretary of State than there were in 2016, people who want to be able to take control of Donald Trump's foreign policy and carry out his desires. But the only thing that Donald Trump has really said about Ukraine is that he would end the war in a day. So now we're going to have to see how he actually plans to go about doing that. But I think it would be a peace, if there is a peace, that that is one that is more sympathetic towards Russia than Ukraine, just judging on Donald Trump's rhetoric and the fact that if there's going to be an immediate peace, it would have to be one that Ukraine may not like and might require giving up territory.
And on Gaza and Israel, he has said, hasn't he, that he wants the war there to finish quickly. Mm-hmm. But again, an absence of detail.
Yeah, exactly. And he, according to the Israelis, he called to congratulate Israel on its military operations in Lebanon. So this is not the kind of view that would lead one to predict that if the war ends quickly, it's going to end in a way that the Palestinians want or the surrounding Arab nations want. He can exert pressure, and that pressure may be to encourage Israel or support Israel in even more aggressive military operations. operations, and that's the way it ends. Donald Trump in 2015 and 2016 and during this campaign has been very vague about his foreign policy beyond kind of these broad strokes where he would put America first and stand up to America's adversaries and lean more on one-on-one relations rather than coalitions and vast partnerships and organizations. Now, when that is carried out into practice this time around, we can't really predict how it's going to shake out.
Meanwhile, for the Democrats, some bloodletting, one assumes. I mean, Kamala Harris will speak eventually, and obviously she will certify the result as vice president, and there isn't going to be any effort to challenge Donald Trump on any front. He has plainly won. But we heard from a Democratic consultant, someone who's campaigned alongside Kamala Harris an hour or so ago, that actually she'd made the wrong vice presidential pick. She should have picked the governor of Pennsylvania and might, through that, have won votes that she didn't get otherwise. I mean, there is going to be a considerable fallout, to put
it
mildly.
There's going to be a circular firing squad.
And against Joe Biden, actually, as well.
That was what I was about to say. I think the knives are going to come out for Joe Biden. The blame is going to be placed squarely on Joe Biden for not relinquishing the reins of power and abandoning his reelection bid much, much earlier. That would have allowed a more robust primary process where someone could build a campaign up and introduce themselves to the American public on a longer time frame than Kamala Harris had. I think, at least at the moment, Democrats look at Kamala Harris's campaign and will have said that she ran a fairly effective one, that she played a bad hand about as best as she could. She had a clear campaign message. She did well in the debate. Maybe she didn't pick the right vice presidential running mate, but this was such a solid win for Donald Trump that Josh Shapiro, even if he delivered Pennsylvania, and he may not have been able to, that wouldn't have, turned some of these other battleground states around. So the second guessing with her may not be as pronounced as what's coming for Joe Biden, because this was the bed he made, and now Democrats are sleeping in it.
Anthony Sasha, thank you very much.
And just a reminder, at 12 minutes to 9, that once we do come off air at 9 o'clock, you can still keep up to date with the election across the BBC, not least with a new edition of Americast on BBC Sounds, which is going to be recorded, I believe, straight after we finish on here. So you're not done yet, Justin.
That is correct.
Is that right?
We will be going up to the stranger to the kitchen of the Washington DC office, which is the only place where we can gather. But we will be talking more, actually, just to be serious for a second, to talk a bit more about what Anthony was saying about what happens to the Democratic Party, because I think people will be focusing, as he was saying, in the coming days and weeks on who Donald Trump picks. But it is also vitally important now that the Democrats find some way of coming to terms with what has happened to them. And as we've been hearing throughout the program, also hoping against hope that they have won the House of Representatives. So still, in a sense, have a toe in the door of the corridors of power, if that's not a mixed metaphor, which it is.
It is, but we'll take it. And you've got a lot more to say, and you aren't going to get any more sleep. But hopefully you'll get some decent hot beverages in that kitchen where you found some broadcast America. So stick with that. Stay with with us on Radio 4 for the twists and turns throughout the day with our colleagues at The World at 1 p.m. and The World Tonight. You go from today to that. And also, as we mentioned earlier, at 9 o'clock, Dr. Sean Williams with Life Changing. And this week, the story of a civil engineer who's caught up in a violent hostage crisis in Algeria.
Right, let us turn now to more of the implications of Donald Trump's win, specifically the implications for business and finance and indeed the international money markets. Simon Jack, our business editor, is on the line. And those implications sinking in, presumably already.
Yes, Justin, some quite sharp moves in financial markets as we hurtle into what is expected to be a Trump win. You've heard of something called the Trump trade, and that is based on what will be the implications of his policies. So these sweeping tariffs he's promised on non-American companies exporting into the US, primarily China, that will make those goods more expensive. That will be inflationary, at the same time protecting US car makers, for example, like those made by his good friend Elon Musk, but also those from Mexico. He's threatened tariffs on Mexican imports if they don't do something about the border. So both of those things inflationary. There's going to be more borrowing to fund the tax cuts he's promised, and that means you've seen government borrowing costs rise. There's been a rise in the 10-year treasury. That's the price that the US government can borrow at. And all of that means you could have higher interest rates for longer. Higher interest rates for longer makes dollar deposits more attractive. So you've seen the dollar go up. Meanwhile, oil, interestingly, is down. And that's because you may remember he promised a drill, baby, drill, which not just good for US companies in the short term, but also it's an instrument of foreign policy, according to those close to him, because it's a good way, if you flood the market with US oil, it brings the oil price down over time. And that's an effective way to hobble the economies, for example, of Iran and Ukraine. And meanwhile, Bitcoin, he's a big enthusiast for that, wants to make the US a crypto superpower. And that has hit this morning a record high.
On the tariffs, when you talk to Trump's supporters, including quite senior people who may be in positions of importance in the Treasury, et cetera, what they generally say about those is it's a bargaining position. He won't actually do it. In the world of business, and I suppose the money markets as well, is there a view that he will?
Well, I think there's a view that his bark is worse than his bite, and that he is a very transactional president. And rather than doing these big multilateral global trade deals, he's very keen on just saying, well, let's play fair with each other. If you we want to export to you and you export to us, let's make sure it's a level playing field. He feels very clearly that China does not represent that, that state-owned companies get unfair subsidies, particularly in things like electric cars. So I think it will be a bargaining chip in bilateral transactional relationships with other countries. I should also say that this whole approach is not without economic risk to the US, because the debt pile that America has is $35 trillion, and it accelerated very quickly under his last presidency. It's expected to do that again with all his planned tax cuts. He's already spending over $1 trillion in interest alone per year. And this sort of US economic favoritism or isolationism, whatever you want to call it, will also spur attempts by other countries to attempt to lessen the power, the yoke, if you like, of the dollar as the world's reserve currency. But I expect things to be pretty volatile as we see how much, as you say, of his election promises he implements and how quickly.
Yeah. Simon Jack, thank you.
At 7 minutes to nine, let's try to have the long view. We may be days away from the final result officially, but early clues obviously telling us what a new President Trump would look like for the world in terms of foreign affairs and the economy. Professor Neil Ferguson, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, Stanford University, and author of several books on world history, joins us, as does Zanny Minton-Beddoes, Editor-in-Chief of The Economist. Good morning to you both. Professor Neil Ferguson, to come to you first. Many unanswered questions this morning about what the next stage of a President Trump would look like for world affairs, not least for Ukraine.
Well, that's right. A lot is going to depend on whom he picks for the security posts. Most people in Europe are, maybe except in Ukraine, are fearful of a Trump presidency. But the Ukrainians know that the course that we're currently on, the Biden-Harris course, is a course leading to defeat. And the hope is that Trump will pick Robert O'Brien, his former national security advisor, for example, and other more hawkish Republicans, perhaps Tom Cotton, and have a national security team committed to what they call peace through strength, an old Ronald Reagan slogan. And that means increasing the pressure on Russia to force Putin to the negotiating table. That's the upside scenario. But I'll say this before Zanny does. There's a downside scenario in which you see more isolationist influences, people who simply want to hand Ukraine to Putin in short order. So we have to watch really closely who gets the key jobs. But I'm leaning more optimistic simply because the alternative would have been an inexorable Ukrainian defeat by pursuing the current policy of de-escalation rather than escalation.
Zanny Minton-Beddoes, The Economist, endorsed Kamala Harris for president. How are you feeling this morning?
Well, I'm hoping that a Trump presidency will be not as risky and dangerous as I worry that it might be. The reason we endorsed Kamala Harris is that we felt that the tail risk of Trump was too dangerous. And I think that is absolutely the case this morning, particularly given the scale of his win. This is a massive win. This is a new era for the United States. It's not just that he's the first president since Grover Cleveland to win non-consecutive terms. It's also that he's won the popular vote. Republicans have retaken the Senate, and they may well keep the House. So he will be almost completely unconstrained. And I think both domestically and in foreign policy, this is really the end of whatever you want to call it, the post-1945 US-led era, to something different. And domestically, he believes in tariffs, he believes in tax cuts, deregulation and deportation. It's a whole different domestic policy, which, as you just heard from Simon Jack, has tremendous economic risks. And internationally, Neil may be right. And in the case of Ukraine, we really don't know what he's going to do, whether he's going to sell Ukraine down the river, or whether, in fact, he thinks that perhaps Ukraine might be, he doesn't care about alliances. So if Ukrainian soldiers can help mean that there'll be fewer need for American soldiers in Europe, maybe he'd even allow Ukraine into NATO. We just don't know. But what we know is that he is transactional and unpredictable, and he's a genuine protectionist. This is an America that is much more like the America before the Second World War. It's returning to many of the kinds of sentiments that it had before 1945. And I think Trump is, he won't necessarily be catastrophic. It may be, much like Trump won, that it will be a volatile, you know, scary moment, but nothing terrible will happen. And it may actually, Neil may be right, that for Ukraine, he may end up being better than a Kamala Harris administration would have been. For Europe as a whole, I think it's definitely more dangerous. If Europe doesn't wake up now to realize that it needs to spend more on its own defense, it needs to pull together much more.
Let me bring in Neil back at this point, because, I mean, are you optimistic at this result? Because there's a different sentiment coming from Zani.
Of course, I'm optimistic, because if we'd had a dead heat, if we'd had something like a close result in 2020 or the even closer result in 2000, I think there would be real volatility in markets. This is a clear victory. The American people have unequivocally rejected the policies of the last 4 years. And I have to disagree with Zani. The real significance of this is the repudiation of an unsuccessful economic policy that produced a spike in inflation, an unsuccessful foreign policy that produced wars not only in Eastern Europe, but in the Middle East, and the repudiation of a social agenda that one could call woke for short, but which in its various progressive manifestations alienated not just white Americans, not just working class Americans, but Latin Americans, Hispanics. It alienated people right across the country. And I think it's good that the Democratic Party has received the clear message that the American people do not want those policies. They want peace through strength, and they want prosperity without inflation. And they certainly don't want wokeism in social policy. So it's a good thing.
Zani, we're nearly out of time, but just a word back.
Very lastly on that, Neil, you may be right on some of the social stuff. You're wrong on the economic policy. Trump's policy, with much bigger tax cuts, is likely to be much more inflationary than anything we've seen thus far.
Well, that was succinct.
You will be wrong, Zani, as you have been before.
You will be wrong. Okay, so there are predictions already being made in the light of this result. Justin, let me bring you back in at this point in Washington. Your take just as we end?
I mean, it's interesting that the two of them do agree, though, on the social stuff. And I think that is going to be where the Democratic Party focuses now its attention as it licks its wounds and thinks about the future. I think there is a feeling among some members of it that it no longer understands the nation that Neil Ferguson described at the beginning of this